God, it's over. You make believe that nothing is wrong until you're crying. And you make believe that life is too long until you're dying. You make believe that nothing is wrong until you're crying. Crying on me, you make believe that life is too long until you're dying. Dying, dying on me.
HD1 Detroit.
Now.
This is Night Call, Detroit's longest running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 248-544-WRIF. That's 248-544-9743. Or text the riff at 4WRIF. That's 49743. Night Call is on the air. Here are your hosts, Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome, everyone. Hi, Jalene.
Hello, here we are.
Wow, we have power. 200,000 people in the area do not have power.
Oh.
And tornadoes ripped through the Midwest. 5 dead, dozens injured.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
There were incredible. Like 6. Yeah, the last time I paid any attention to it, there were reportedly 60 touchdowns of tornadoes.
Wow.
So, it was scary, and what was even more frightening for me, my partner in Thought Crime, Crime Think, Peter Werby, and in radio,
crimes, yeah.
Is that you were getting on an airplane to
I
come
was in
back
the air,
here.
Yeah. I was, and I wasn't in Vegas with the rest of the Rift crew.
The Rift crew. We got left behind again.
Yeah, but we did. So I went off to Dallas. You know, what the hell? If you can't go to Vegas, go to Dallas, right?
Or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, right. So I get on the plane, and I'm looking at the weather here in Detroit, and it says, like, severe storms, dangerous winds, tornado watch, and
yeah.
I'm thinking, they're actually going to fly in this?
Yeah.
And then, so we got on the plane, and as soon as we get on the plane, they say, well, it looks bad in Detroit, we can't take off. Something.
And
why
so
the hell did they put us on the plane?
Did you sit on that plane that entire time?
No, they actually, since they had the sky, what is it called? Skyway? No. What's, you know, the ramp.
Okay. Whatever.
The jetway.
The jetway, okay.
The jetway. They had the jetway connected.
The ramp, yeah.
So they let people off.
Oh, good.
And 3/4 of the people stayed on.
Did you stay on?
No.
You were like, I'm out of here?
I mean, I'm pretty claustrophobic as
yeah,
it
true.
Is. You know,
you don't so. Really dig the whole airplane scene. I mean, you're a lot better than you were, say, 15 years ago. When you just were so annoyed by me and my People magazine. And
you were reading casually, and I thought we were going to our doom.
We were just going to
no,
D.C.
I, listen, I am such a world traveler now
yep.
that I did not
you
have
travel to, more than me now.
Oh, yeah, all the time. Not only that, I did not have to take off my shoes.
Oh, I heard that they had lifted that shoe ban.
It depends on how frequently you fly.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
So the next time I get on a plane, I'll be taking my shoes off.
I was pre-screened, as they said.
Okay, yeah.
Because yeah.
I haven't flown in, it's been about a year and a half.
Really?
Well, no, actually, well, maybe it has been that long, yeah.
Oh, this is really interesting.
Well, I want to know, and I already know, but I think you should explain to everyone what you were. Did you go? I know you didn't go to Texas to check out, to do the JFK thing, even though you did the JFK.
I did the JFK.
That wasn't your ultimate reason.
Well, let's kind of bring people up to speed on everything. This is WRF's community talk show. You get to call in and give your opinion on the air, along with Jalene and I. We're going to hog the mics. That's just the way talk shows go, but we'll give you a little shout-out.
You're more
shout
of a mic hog than me. But that's okay.
You could have had the whole thing. I almost didn't come back. Oh, yeah. So about an hour and 15 minutes into it, we didn't finish that story. They said, okay, we're taking off. And it was just this smooth flight. And I come back here and trees are down.
Yes.
I mean, I had the roughest part of it was driving from Metro over to our house.
Was it?
Yeah.
Pretty
flooded
shaky
streets, freeways were flooded and all that. Anyways, you can ring us up.
You made it home safely.
Yeah,
here.
Yeah. I mean, it was no problem. 248-544-WRIF.
I got it this week. 248-544-9743.
You got it. And you can see some of the stuff I did if you go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/nightcall. And actually, not up on my website yet, but you can always see that. Peter Werbe, werbe.com. You want to text us? We are ready to receive your texts.
We are. Yes, mm-hmm. 49743.
Let me see. So looking, I want to look.
I like that we have that option. I feel like I think it's a nice little avenue. Yeah. Although we prefer to hear your lovely voices. Yeah. You can feel free to text.
Right. Well, here, if you go to our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/nightcall, gives a list of who the guests are going to be at 1 a.m. that I'm going to interview. But it also has a photograph of our good friend, singer-songwriter David Rovics. And also below that, a photograph of me. I didn't realize. I didn't
put the captions you wanted in there. I apologize.
Yeah, they just look like, let's have a look. No, there's.
Didn't I say where you were?
No. Well,
oh,
it says, Peter at Dealey Plaza today, which is where Kennedy was shot.
Okay, well, at least I got that done.
Yeah.
Listen, but I was.
So boring. I mean, I'm standing in front of a building and I'm standing on a lawn.
It was Saturday night and you've got me working. I mean, what is this? Aren't there labor laws?
I guess so. All right. Well, here was the deal. Here's why I went to Dallas. A friend of mine and ours, who Jalene knows, my wife and I and all of our friends, is doing 22 big ones in federal prison for environmental sabotage. She took it upon herself, not a good choice of tactics, to intervene in a couple of environmental protests in a manner that the government didn't look.
You're cleaning that up pretty good.
Yeah, right. Well, arson, yeah. This was a Monsanto research office, which was doing research on genetically modified organisms, GMOs. And she and her husband had tried to organize people to protest, to say, look, you don't know what's going to happen when these Frankenstein genes get out into the.
And look where it is now.
Yeah, exactly.
She must be thrilled, though, that there's attention being paid to GMOs on a national and international scale.
Sure.
It wasn't when she was.
No, it was 1999, and I should say her name is Marie Mason. You can go to supportmariemason.org and get the whole story, or you can just go to our Facebook page, Nightcall, and see that as well. And she actually got away with it, and then 8 years later, her husband turned her in.
Ex-husband turned state's evidence,
call
it?
He did.
And he turned her in, and I mean, that's just the dirty part of the story. You know, do you ever really know someone? Do I even know you, Peter Werbe? No,
I'd drop a dime on you in a minute.
I think you probably would. But he ended up with how many years? Four or five?
He's getting out in 2013 this year.
Yeah.
She's getting out in 2031.
That's crazy.
Yeah, that's scary.
Yeah, and so, he said, hey, you know what, I'm going to turn a dime on her, and there she is in federal prison.
Yeah, drop a dime on her.
Drop a dime, I mean.
Yeah.
I like to change it up.
I wonder if folks know what that means. That's like something from the 40s when phone calls used to be a dime. And there was this thing, for those of you who are under 20, there was this thing called payphones.
Yes. I think there are still.
And you could
some
drop money in them.
There.
Imagine that. You could drop money in them. And because that people, and I know if you can imagine this, people did not have cell phones.
There are still payphones. Yeah. I actually received a phone call from a payphone about 3 weeks ago.
Really?
Yeah, and it wasn't someone in jail or
anything. A drunk ex-boyfriend.
No.
Asking for money.
No. No. That was that was 2 weeks
There's
ago.
Too many stories going here. Anyway, singular. David Rovick. and I, the singer-songwriter. You can go to David Rovics, R-O-V-I-C-S.com, and he's got all these. He's a troubadour. This is
he's been on this show.
Yes, this is like, you know, are we ever going to bring these together?
We are.
David Rovics is a troubadour in the sense that he does topical songs, three a week sometimes.
Yep, he can.
He might do it about Fukushima or NSA spying,
GMOs,
all that.
Manning,
and the thing is, it's so amazing that he's able to, he has all this incredible amount of information that he puts into a song, and it rhymes, you know, to be.
Yeah, he's got a good knack for that.
So he's an old pal of ours and of mine, and so he had a gig in Dallas. And I thought this would be a great time because he has visited Marie as well in the Carswell. Actually, it's called the Federal Medical Center Carswell. Forget about the medical center deal. In fact, there the medical care is so bad. If you have something wrong, you have to get on a list to get on a list to get the medical care. There's a list to get on the list.
Unless it's an emergency.
Yeah, if it's an emergency, right, like that. So, well, the sentence. So, Marie Mason got 22 years for environmental sabotage, arson, and all that. And I've seen sometimes when stories about her have been reported, and always these insane people that write on these comments, and so they're saying, "Good, she should have got life," and all of this.
First of all, we need to say no one was injured.
No one was injured at all, you know, to be sure.
And then let's compare that to people for. Example, the Trayvon Martin case. Well, that's a bad example because no one did any time.
Yeah.
But, you know, say something like that happened and someone got manslaughter. Maybe the guy who killed the young woman in Dearborn Heights.
Just indicted.
Raina, or
charged.
Yeah. You know, maybe he'll get 2 years. She's in there for 22.
Yeah. How about this one? Anders Breivik, who was the mass murderer in Norway who killed 77 teenagers. Just opening fire on him because they were social Democrats. They were socialist youth. He got 21 years.
21 years.
Another, Marie Mason got 22 years essentially for arson.
They stuck it to her hard.
An arsonist in Detroit burned down an apartment building. Four firefighters were injured. One crippled permanently. It was actually featured in that documentary about Detroit firefighters called Burn. And he was sentenced to 15 years in jail, and he appealed it and said, I was promised a deal, and so he's going to get like 7 to 9.
So what's the moral of the story here?
Burn things down for profit, not for trying to save the environment.
Okay.
I guess. Actually, it's a bad tactic. It's certainly illegal, and it has bad consequences. But the idea, and so why did she get so many years? Well, because... there is something called the Terrorism Enhancement Act. And if it is seen as an act of trying to intimidate or terrorize someone, which it wasn't, it was an attempt to physically destroy the research that was done on GMOs. And again, I'm certainly not supporting the tactic. And I would have known.
Nothing's really going to stop Monsanto. I mean, except a worldwide movement.
Yeah, or a worldwide collapse of the ecosphere because of
their
GMOs.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew her when she was doing it, but I had no idea she did that. In fact, we were talking about that because I visited her in federal prison both Saturday and Sunday. Today and yesterday, and I said, when did you do this? And she said, New Year's Eve at midnight at Y2K, you know, at 2000.
Really?
And I said, this is true. I said, I wondered why you and your husband didn't come to our New Year's party.
Oh my gosh,
they were busy.
The craziest story.
They were busy. Yeah, they were busy doing some arson. So anyway. There is this worldwide movement calling for justice for Marie Mason. Nobody says that she should be released with no punishment. But
correct.
The idea that someone is going to spend, she's like 51 or 52 and got another 18 years. And I don't think she'd do it again. Right?
I don't think she would either. She's already done 4 then, huh?
Yeah, yeah. Well,
time seems to fly on this side of the
prison. Yeah, it does.
Prison
it's
gates.
Probably going kind of short.
Slower
there. Yeah. So I'm trying to think what else. We just caught up on stuff. And
I mean, what's there to catch up on when there's nothing new? You're in prison. You got her caught up, right?
Yeah, right. You know, where are they? What happened to? How's so-and-so? You know, what have you? But, you know, she spends all of her time just reading and reading newspapers. So she was just boom, bam, 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 bam.
She
bam,
had
bam.
All the info, huh?
Yeah, she had the info. And but she also is a singer-songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
So she and the guy I visited in federal prison with, David Rovics, they sang some songs together and some of David's songs. And and you can download David's songs for free, davidrovics.org.
Yeah.
And she's just written a new song called Blood and Ivory about poaching ivory tusks,
ooh,
which is still going on. And, I mean, very sad song given what's happening,
well,
but beautiful.
All of the songs, well, sure, but these songs aren't necessarily for entertainment purposes.
No.
They are, but they're about serious issues around the world, and that's
sure.
what Rovics does, and then Marie. And what did the prison guard, he's probably thinking, what in the hell are these people singing about?
Well, there was actually, you would think, let me tell you something else, too. Marie Mason, who was convicted of arson and given these terrorism enhancement lengthening
charges
of her sentence, she is in the most restrictive women's prison in the United States. Pardon me, in the United States. And she, for instance, here, she's this environmentalist. And I've been talking since 8 a.m. I'm going to see what happens
yeah.
to my voice here. I may have to just sit back and let you do it, Julie. Pardon me. That her feet, since she's got to this unit, this administration unit in Carswell Prison in Fort Worth, Texas, which is a twin city with Dallas,
yeah.
Her feet have not touched anything but concrete in that entire time.
Wow.
There is this football size. No, what am I talking about?
Football size.
Not even that big. A third of it that has that's asphalt, and there's razor wire all over it. Razor wire on top. So she has not seen the sky except through razor wire in 3 or 4 years.
And does she go out?
She can go outside 1 hour a day, and she looked pallid. And here, I'll tell you, this unit, it's called the administrative unit, and it is designated as being for escapees, assault of personalities, disciplinary problems, everything like that, and other management issues.
So
she says, why am I in? And she was in a medium security prison. So she said, what have I done and how do I get out of here? And the warden says, it's not up to us, coming right from Washington. So
really?
This is all under the National Federal Bureau of Prisons and the FBI because, these environmentalists got so frustrated. They tried to create these mass movements. Like up at, for instance, another one of the things that Marie Mason and her husband tried to do was to stop logging of old growth forest
mm-hmm.
in Michigan.
So they did this, did they spike trees?
They didn't just spike trees. I think they did something to logging equipment, smashed it or they didn't burn it, anything like that. So, but they tried to get people up there. They'd have a demonstration to stop, cutting down some 300-year-old tree. And 11 people would show up. No, I didn't. What were we going to do? Go 200 miles north to do it? So the frustration of the assault of development on the natural world sent them over the edge. They said, because once you let GMOs into the ecosphere, the argument's over. There's no debate or anything. They're here.
Yeah.
And they, to the point where Monsanto, which has this huge investigative department, that if you try to save seeds from last year to replant, they're their seeds. You're buying their patented seeds.
Yeah.
They will come and file these lawsuits
like
against you.
Like the Gestapo.
And people, for instance, have had organic farms that have had, just because this pollen's in the wind, and they have stopped these people from growing their corn because they had been cross-pollinated by, quote, their corn, by Monsanto's corn.
Crazy.
So, yeah. So what they're doing, and this is kind of an odd concept, they're monetizing land. In other words, the big wealth in the Middle Ages and the feudalism system was based on land ownership.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's important. But then the products became important, these huge international conglomerates like Cargill and all that control all this food and what have you. But firms like Monsanto actually are beginning to control the seed stock of the world.
They are.
Yeah. If they don't already, I'm sorry, I don't know, I shouldn't say that. Like, they have ruined small farms in Mexico because of NAFTA. Because what's now imported for making tortillas and other corn products in Mexico is this U.S. corn, this GMO. It's all GMO corn that's grown here.
Franken food.
Yeah. And so what happens, and this is where you can start tying this into things like immigration. So you had millions and millions, I don't want to go millions and millions and millions, but at least millions and millions of small farmers, subsistence farmers, in Mexico that were driven off their land because they could no longer compete with the prices of the imported corn, left, and I mean, I may have even mentioned this before, and went in, and this is what happened in all countries where industrialism began in the 19th century. It's just, repeating itself here.
As history tends to do.
Yeah. So they, most of the people that were ruined went into Mexico City, places like that, where there's already like 24 million people. That's one city. But the really ambitious ones, the ruined farmers, the ones from towns that were collapsing, what did they do? They said, I've got to support my family. So they came north.
Yes.
So literally NAFTA, which has driven millions of U.S. industrial jobs out of the United States.
They're driving people from...
poor people, impoverished people from Mexico into the United States. Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. So it's a whole horrible circle.
Well, the one thing about GMOs is there is backlash. There is backlash, and it's ever growing. I mean, there are countries that don't allow GMOs. Europe actually. Yeah. No GMOs are allowed. Haiti rejected seeds from Monsanto, and it's ever growing. And, I'm just looking forward to the day when it really starts happening here. It's at a talk level that now, and lobbying and, campaigning is, and big money is winning.
Did you send me this?
I did.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about this all? This is from Mother Jones, an absolutely terrific magazine and website. You can go to motherjones.com. Mother Jones, 100 years ago, was a feisty, elderly union organizer.
I would have loved her.
Yeah. And it says, Big Food wants to crush the GMO labeling movement. Why don't these people want us to know what is in the product?
Yeah, what do you have to hide?
Well, right? I think they're afraid that people will, say,
get upset
I don't
and
that.
Say we're not going to eat this.
Exactly. Because you want to know how much, is there, what is it, partially hydrogenated
oil,
blah blah's in it and all that.
Quote unquote.
Yeah. And do you have it right here? Do you want to talk about this at all?
I do. The author of this article is talking about, he said, I'm just going to say the names.
Go ahead. It's in the article.
Coke, Pepsi, Nestle, et cetera. This was his logic, that they profitably operate in Europe where GMO ingredients are scarce and labeling is mandatory, which none of that is going on. It's starting to happen here, I believe, isn't it, Peter?
No, it's going the other way. It lost in Washington.
Oh, it just did. Presumably, they could do so in the United States, too. He said, eventually, I figured they'd tire of fighting the agrochemical GMO seed industry's fight. I pointed to a statement made yesterday by the big food trade group, the Grocery Manufacturers Association, and you can blame them also for your high prices at the grocery store, to the effect that it would advocate for national standards for the safety and labeling of products made with GMO ingredients. And he said, boy, was I naive.
The author says that, it says that that in this voter initiative, electoral initiative in Washington, the simple thing said, let's label the food. Let's tell folks what's in it.
What they're putting in their bodies.
Yeah, and the Washington State Attorney General sued what's the GMA here? We're talking about GMA. They like GMO. The GMA, you just said it, was Groceries Manufacturers Association. They spend more than $7 million to fight the labeling initiative while shielding the identity of its contributors. And to settle the matter, the GMA revealed the names of the companies, which turned out to be Pepsi, Coca-Cola, General Mills, and Nestle. I was drinking some water. I can't remember. Was it Azteca or something like that in Dallas? Today I looked at it. Nestle's, it's all... increasingly this monopolization.
It sure is. Yeah. And it used to be, remember the days when Nestle was just simply a chocolate bar?
Yeah.
Now it's everything. Now it's like household chemicals and you name it. It's everything. I mean, it's no joking matter, but gee whiz.
If you're just joining us, I was talking how I just came back from Dallas and I visited a federal prisoner who was in for environmental sabotage, an act of arson against an office that was doing GMO research. And I said, it's nothing. I told her if I would have known she was doing it, I would have tied her to a chair.
Yeah, no doubt.
And not
she's pretty feisty.
She's pretty feisty. She would have just, you know, done one of these Superman things and broke the bounds. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, but so when I arrived there, it was really good. David Rovics, the singer-songwriter, he picked me up from the airport. And then we drove through Dallas. I just couldn't believe it. It is endless freeways being built with insane clover leaves. You know what I mean? You know, different ramps.
Yeah.
To the point where I thought, these things don't even go anywhere. It must be just an art project.
It is pretty crazy. I mean, I've been spent time in Dallas before, and I can imagine. It's been a few years.
You couldn't. This was all looked like it was in the last 6 months. In fact, everything looked like the town had been built in the last 6 months or
something. Well, everything's very clean there. You live in Detroit.
So we drove to a gig that David Rovics was doing, and, you know, so he sang for his supper, and... And then the next morning, we went to the federal prison, FMC Carswell, and visited Marie Mason. And then...
How long can you stay?
We were actually there for 4.5 hours.
Really?
Yeah.
And why would they... I mean, this the whole prison thing fascinates me.
It's weird.
It's very... On a weird level. How can they? You go 2 days in a row?
Well, I don't know. Because of the unit, the restrictive unit that Marie Mason is in... They can only have the people in the administrative unit, this highly restrictive, highly punitive unit that she's in, and unreasonably and for no reason, you know, unlike most of the other people that are in there that have committed offenses in prison, that they give you this, your own little room, look like a room kind of in a...
Like a classroom?
Like a almost like a classroom, like in a university or a hospital. And it's got a table and chairs, and a guard is sitting in there with you where he or she just kind of reads.
Was it a he or a she?
Well, but there was altogether about four.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you feel like they were listening to you?
Well, this is kind of funny. So we're talking, and I notice the guard has fallen asleep. And then David Rovics, my friend, he puts his head down on the table and goes to sleep.
Did he really?
Yeah. So I said to the prisoner I'm visiting, Marie, I said, you know, Marie, if I go to sleep, you're all by yourself.
Oh, God.
Yeah. But anyway, so here, this very restrictive unit, you think you got mean guards? They were sweet.
Really?
They like her so much.
Oh.
She was teaching one of them play guitar. This big, huge guard, you know, told us he was a biker, and he called her his mentor. And so I was with David Rovics, a singer-songwriter.
Wow, that's
and so, and David plays some pretty rad songs. If you've probably heard, if you go to his website, davidrovics.com, R-O-V-I-C-S, .com, download for free, and
he's not afraid. He'll do it right there.
So the guy said, well, you know, here's a guitar, play something, and he said, what should I play?
And so they did give him a guitar.
Yeah. So Marie says, St. Patrick's Brigade. And I go, no, you don't want to do that one. And she kept that going.
Every single one.
So he sang this traditional, Irish ballad.
Oh, I know which one you're talking about.
Yeah, and then sang a Christian hymn.
And he's an atheist.
Yeah. But so
he's trying to confuse people?
So, well, no, he was trying to keep on the good side of the guard, I think.
That's funny because he does not care. And what are the restrictions? I mean, what that they place upon you, like physically? You know, can you touch them or?
You can, when you walk in, you can give a 3-second hug. And on the way out, you can give a 3-second hug. That's it.
Wow.
Yeah. Whereas in the general population, they have this huge room, and everybody's in there with kids. And, I mean, it's a women's prison. It's really weird, you know, because you just, you know, you walk through this yard, and there's maybe like 100 women staring hungrily at you.
Stop it. That's what you think. not. Don't be so sure.
They got their own thing going?
Quite possibly.
They're in there. Yeah. All right. So then David says, what do you want to do? And I said, we're in Dallas. Let's go to Dealey Plaza where the Kennedy assassination took place.
It's very timely as well.
Yeah, because on Friday is the 50th anniversary of that.
And were there a lot of people there?
There wasn't. We got there a little late, and there's something called the Sixth Floor Museum, which is.
I took that tour.
Oh, did you?
My friend's dad was one of the attorneys on the Warren Commission.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
David Bellin.
That was a load of horse manure. The Warren Commission.
Well, I don't like speaking of the dead.
Yeah. Well, anyway. So on our Facebook page, facebook.com/nightcall, you can see a photograph of me, and I should have taken one more of the building. It's the Texas Texas Book Depository building in which Oswald was.
So you didn't take that little tour.
There the line was was around the block
right now.
Yeah. So no, we didn't do it, and it was weird. And some people were just like hanging out, you know.
Yeah.
Other.
So it was when I was there.
Yeah, and then in the street, there's actually two X's. One where the first shot occurred, and one where the second shot occurred. And there didn't seem to be a single person there that thought Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin. That's for
really?
Sure.
Really? Huh?
But that's not unusual because 60% of the American people think that there was a conspiracy. What did we say last week? And something like, I can't remember what it adds up to, 16% don't know and 23% think that it was Oswald. And that adds up to 99% because the other 1% think that Barack Obama was responsible.
Oh, God. Or George Bush.
Yeah.
Hey, so did you enjoy it? Did you get anything out of it?
Yeah, it was very strange.
I didn't get anything out of it.
Well, I've just followed that, that case and have read all this stuff.
Yeah.
And think there was a conspiracy of some sort. In fact, tonight at 1 a.m., I'm going to be featuring an interview with Lamar Waldron. He's written a new book. He's got a huge one out. It's called The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination. And he names the conspirators. He has all this FBI stuff. He has confessions to doing it by the New Orleans mafia boss, Carlo Marcello, who's the chief conspirator. And
who's probably not around.
No, he's long gone. And he has taped, the FBI had taped recordings of Marcello telling another inmate who was an FBI plant in prison. And Leonardo DiCaprio. DiCaprio, yeah. Not DiCaprio.
No, he's good. I like him.
Leonardo DiCaprio is making a film of Lamar Waldron's book. And
the interest will never die in this.
Yeah, I know. And Carlo Marcello is going to be played by De Niro.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, perfect.
All right. More on that. There are some really, if you haven't been there, there's some very curious aspects to that, little setting there in Dealey Plaza.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk about that. And I'm also interested. Remember a couple of years ago, I just said, hey, hit the phones and tell me who you think did it.
Yeah.
And it was all CIA, mostly.
Well, I want to hear it. Maybe people have changed their minds. Plus, we have new people. So.
All right. Here's the number.
You're listening to the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night Call.
This next song goes out to someone real special. Web developers. You've developed a World Wide Web of convenience, and Geico.com is eternally grateful. Now everyone can pay bills, manage policies, maybe save big money on car insurance, all from the comfort of their desk chairs, recliners, and water beds. You're magicians with wands made of binary code. And that's why we're sending this next song out to you. For a free rate quote, visit Geico.com.
You can always tell how good a football team is by their starting lineup. The same goes for Buffalo Wild Wings, like our legendary Hall of Fame starter, the 82 Pepperoni Pockets, the hunger-crushing Pub Burger, loaded with bacon and beer cheese, the Stampede Burger, packed with a fiery kickoff of jalapenos, our beefy Reuben Burger, and of course, our star quarterback, the Hail Mary Burger, coated with our very own spicy Bloody Mary ketchup. Now, who can compete with that roster?
Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports.
Hey, music lovers. Tired of your music buffering while you're running around? Here's a reality check. Verizon's 4G LTE is the most reliable and in more places than any other 4G network. Reliability you can believe in. That's powerful. Verizon. Click on the banner to compare the maps.
Our son would go from, "Good morning, Mom," to words you'd never expect to come out of your child's mouth. Our pain came from not knowing what to do. He was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. 5 or 6 years later, he was diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder. I think the hardest part of living with someone who has a mental illness is thinking that you're alone, that no one else could understand. NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, is made up of people who live it every day. We lean on each other and we learn from each other. NAMI doesn't let anyone give up hope. My name is Mary Tadigan, and I can tell you what NAMI has meant for my family. It has meant that we are a family.
1 in 5 adults lives with depression, schizophrenia, anxiety, or other mental illnesses. NAMI provides education and support to these families and individuals. To find a local chapter, go to NAMI.org or call 800-950-NAMI.
I try to find the right one, but it seems like they all just have one thing on their mind.
Having only one thing on your mind can be a good thing when you find that special someone. At GEICO.com, that someone is a car insurance policy, and the only thing on its mind is being your soulmate. Depend on easy online tools for paying bills and managing claims. Picture a life of savings as you gaze into the eyes of a free rate quote. That's our go-to move. GEICO. 15 minutes could save you hundreds on car insurance.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. You've got it on the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here are Peter and Julie.
Yeah, well, he's not giving the phone number, is he?
Well, that's our job then.
All right, go ahead.
What is it? 248-544-9743.
Yeah, that's...
new phones.
248-544-WRIF.
I'm not real happy about the change in phone numbers, but it's out of my control.
Yeah. So, we're talking about GMOs. We're talking about a federal prisoner, the David Rovics, the singer-songwriter, and I visited Saturday and Sunday. And very bizarre going into prison and what you got to do. And
was it creepy? It had to be just...
Well, yeah. I mean, you got to... It's like going in the airport.
Yeah.
I mean, so it's that you're used to.
It has to be kind of more than that, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you go in a door, big, huge gate opens, and then you go in, and then it goes,
pow! My God.
You know, and then the other one opens from the other side. I mean, I don't know why they're worried about anybody escaping from there. I don't think nobody could.
Yeah, well.
But it doesn't. I don't think there's a lot of escapes.
They're not going to pull a Shawshank?
No, I don't think so. But, oh, yeah, so I also visited, I was in Dallas this weekend, if you're just joining us, and I just, and I also visited Dealey Plaza, and this is the 50th anniversary, and the controversy continues, and there was an article, which I thought was kind of creepy, kind of creeped me out, when John F. Kennedy was shot, his head really just exploded on, it was very, very horrible,
yeah.
High-powered rifle, some say it was from Oswald, which it could have been. I mean, he could have got off one shot. I doubt whether there's any possibility he could have gotten off two successfully. I was going to say about the geography of Dealey Plaza. Yes.
Yeah, keep talking. I actually have some business to take care of because of the power outages. I need to go take a phone call on the warm line really quick.
Okay.
Some DTE business.
Okay.
So carry on. I'll be right back.
All right. Good. I'll be glad to do that. Anyway, Dealey Plaza is not very big. And, you know, one of the things, I don't know how many of you have shot rifles, and particularly with a scope on it, it's pretty hard to do. And there's something in the Olympics called the biathlon. I think it isn't it the biathlon where you cross country ski with a rifle on your back. And this is like the highest tech, marksman's rifle, sharpshooter rifle you can have. and your heart rate is going like 130, and then you have to sight a target. And in the meantime, your heart's going boom, 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 like that. And it's really difficult. And the idea that Lee Oswald had this gun, you know, this World War One gun, a Mannlicher Carcano that he, what was it, what did he get for, like $18 or $19 or something like that? And so, I mean, you know, it's possible you could have closed your eyes, pulled the trigger, and, you know, just dumb luck, hit your target. Target's moving, too. It wasn't moving very fast. And the sixth floor of the book deposit building, and you can see that where I was just yesterday standing in front of it, wasn't real far from the point where he was shot. It's not like now. You know, no one would ever be able to pull anything off like that if, in fact, it did come from that building. And but then what you would have to do, you would have to eject that shell, the spent shell with the bolt, rack another one into it, and then re-sight it with a scope. I mean, impossible. It's just virtually impossible. That's what it seems to me. However, when you go to the grassy knoll isn't jillions of miles away, right, Jillian?
Yeah.
It's right there.
It's right there.
And you would think if there's
out of that book depository, it's right there.
Yeah. You would think if somebody was blasting away with a rifle from up above in this little kind of grove or something like that, it would be pretty obvious, right?
For sure.
Yeah. So none of it makes sense.
It really doesn't.
It doesn't.
And I'll be right back.
Oh, you're going again? Okay.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
People are without power, and we need to get the word out.
All right. Good. So one of the things that was so poignant, there were so many things. I mean, there was tragedy, of course, with the assassination, but there was also all these poignant moments. One of them was that on the plane back to Washington, that Jackie Kennedy was still wearing this pink Chanel suit and was caked with her husband's blood. And I mean, I'm sorry to say this, and part of his head as well. And she resisted all suggestions from the aides that she clean herself up. Instead, she said, "Let them see what they've done." But for the half century since John F. Kennedy's assassination, the most famous artifact from that day, it didn't strike me like that. I vaguely remember, I mean, I saw black and white photos of it, but they say it was one of the most recognizable articles of clothing ever worn has been seen by almost no one. Is that true? I mean, were all of you aware of that? I wasn't. It's now preserved by the National Archives in a climate-controlled vault outside of Washington. It is subject to Kennedy family restrictions that it not be seen for almost a century more. This is very strange. That sort of creeps me out, too. Why? I mean, why wouldn't you have destroyed that? What does this do? And why would they want this preserved for 150 years? Says that Mrs. Kennedy is so closely linked to an item of clothing is fitting. And then it talks about, then it goes on about, her fashion and how elegant she was and all of that. Just, I have no idea. Or do you think? Do you think that's something that should be kept? I don't know. If you want to reach us, let's see. Well, let's get, we haven't, yeah, that's right, it's a talk show. We're supposed to get you folks on the air. And you can do it by dialing 248-544-WRIF. That's 248-544-9743. We have, as many of you know, always having trouble with this damn email. Now, we don't have the password available, so I'm not getting any of those. But you can text us at 4WRIF, 49743. But let's pick up this call because it's Rick from Farmington, and Rick wants to talk about Dealey Plaza. Rick, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Pete?
Doing good.
Well, I was listening to you and everything, and Pete, I'm 61 years old. I remember this like yesterday.
Yeah.
It was one of the saddest things that could happen to a child, seeing this happen to a president.
Wow.
One of the most highest people in the world, and this person was also good. I've been to Dallas, and it's the weirdest feeling. I've stood there where he was shot, and I've looked back at that building. I've looked at the grassy knoll, and it's like, And nowhere in the world one person did this. I mean, why? My question is, what did Oswald have to gain from this? What did Jack Ruby have to gain from this?
Yeah, we forget about Ruby's little partner. And Rick, if I remember, you're ex-military?
Yes.
So you've had some acquaintance with firearms and
yes.
What's possible. And you think you could have whipped off two shots at a moving target like that?
Not with that gun he had.
No, no.
Not with that gun he had.
Not.
But, you know, like I said, I think the people that had to gain, which we can't really say because of all these conspiracies, are the ones that killed him.
Yeah.
Now, I could start speaking names, but, like, you know, Big Brother's there.
Yeah.
So, but it's, and they keeping this, that dress, so that one day they will put it on view and display.
So you think they should keep that, huh? Keep the dress?
I mean,
Jackie's dress?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So, like, in her own words, look what they done to my husband. I
yeah.
remember when they did that. I remember when John Johnson looted the horse, the riderless horse and the caisson pass. Man, it was like, I mean, we're seeing it live, not the films. We're seeing it live. And it's like, I asked my mom, why did they do this? She said, anybody that's doing good, they kill them.
Hmm.
And she started naming names.
And then it went on in that decade, didn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you know, ain't no telling what old man Kennedy did to put his sons in harm's way.
Sure. And if you think about that decade, we talk about this country and all of its values. And during the 1960s, you think about that, John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King.
That's right.
It's like what you associate with Pakistan or Mexico or something like that, right? And, well,
I don't know if you would want to do that. And we're going. Let's go back to when they killed Lincoln.
Sure.
Lincoln was good.
Yeah.
Medgar Evers was good. Martin Luther King was good. Robert Kennedy was good. John was good. And there's so many more that we don't even know about.
Yeah, well.
Let's talk about the evil ones that was back then. You had J. Edgar Hoover, who didn't like the Kennedys because they just tore his behind apart. You got the CIA. You had Nixon. And you had the Mafia.
And that's what, you know, I'll tell you, I have not read through the book of the man that I'm going to be interviewing at 1 o'clock tonight. And I don't know if this will shock people or shock you, Rick, but I don't always, in fact, I can't do it. I can't read a couple of books a week. I mean, I look through them, and one of the things I have is this sort of inquiring style of questioning. So I try to find out, you know, what is the book about? Why do you say this? What is your main contention? You know, how do you support this and all of that? And Lamar Waldron, who's written the book I don't even have that in front of me, but about the JFK assassination. I mean, he has done the most amazing scholarly research on this, FBI documents, interviewed an enormous number of people and what have you. And yet there are people on the left who think that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin and think that all this conspiracy stuff is just, there are conspiracies, but when the way they put it, it sounds like a pejorative, like a, you know, you're saying, oh, you're making something up where there isn't anything. And on the right, there's a lot of people on the right wing that think it was a conspiracy. And then a lot of the mainstream conservatives, like Bill O'Reilly, like he has had that TV thing, killing Kennedy, because, you know, he wants to blame it on the left to say that Lee Harvey Oswald was this, communist sympathizer that, defected to Russia and all that. Yet they just tie him in with so many, U.S. agencies, but I don't know.
That's the excuse that they use.
Yeah, but you know, Rick,
that's what they had at that time.
If someone said to me, well, who do you think did it? I always say, you know what? I just don't know. All right, let me get some more calls. Always great to talk to you. Thank you, sir. Don't give that old number. The number is 248-544-WRIF. And let's see, here's Ron and Shelby. Ron, hi. It's well, usually it's Peter and Jalene. I don't know where Jalene is, but you got me right now. Go ahead, you're on the air. Did I not do this? Hold on here. I, you know, this new phone says. Yeah, there you go. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, Pete?
Yeah.
Go Peter? Ahead.
Yeah, yeah.
Jalene? It's Ron.
Yeah, Ron.
From Shelby Township.
Yeah.
Well, I was just listening to that last caller about the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah.
And I'm just about as old as him. I'm 57, and I remember that like it was yesterday. I remember exactly where I was, what I was doing. I was in elementary school. I was on the playground, and some kid said that the president got shot with a BB gun. You know how kids, you know.
Yeah.
Kids. And but anyways, I listened to your guest last week about the Kennedy assassination, and there was one question that I am really surprised that you didn't ask him, okay? And I know three things. I know something that I'm not supposed to know, okay?
Yeah, what?
Well, I know the reason why. There are three reasons why Kennedy got shot, okay? And I know something about something that has to do with why Kennedy got shot.
All right, well, tell us quickly, though.
This is what I'm not supposed to know.
Okay.
Okay. About the thing that Cuba was involved, okay, Cuba was not involved.
Right.
Okay. That's a fact. Okay. And the reason why Kennedy got shot, okay, is because he did not, this is known, okay, this was revealed about 15 years ago. The reason Kennedy got shot was because he wanted to disband the CIA for one thing, okay? Second, the reason, he got shot, he did not want to go to Vietnam, okay? And I'll get back to that. There's a reason for that. He did not want to go to Vietnam. The third thing is that he wanted to get rid of the central bank, okay? Just like Lincoln. One of the reasons Lincoln got shot is because he wanted to get rid of the central bank.
Well, I have to say, Ryan, I never heard the third one. Certainly the first two have been said previously, and the CIA was very angry at him that he had denied air cover support for the CIA invasion of Cuba. But one of the things that my guest last week, Peter Kornbluh, who had written an article about the Kennedy assassination for Cigar Aficionado magazine, said, I mean, I thought it was strange. I thought he undermined his own argument that Lee Harvey Oswald was the sole assassin, because he reported from the research that he, Peter Kornbluh, had done. He works for the Cuban Documentation Project of the National Security Archive. Nothing to do with the government. He said that at the moment of Kennedy's assassination, there was an emissary from the U.S. government, from the Kennedy administration in Cuba, trying to normalize relations with the Cuban government. So I'm thinking, isn't that's like another argument for why, you know, something like the CIA could have done it. The guy tonight, I think if you stay up to listen to him, or people can listen to the podcast that'll be available in about 12 hours, Lamar Waldron, is that you know, he says that there was a conspiracy. All right, so I'm going to just have to take your three points like that and say that I appreciate your call. Thank you very much. One of the things that that happened while I was gone is that the man who shot Renisha McBride, the young woman who went to the door of the man in Dearborn Heights and was met by a shotgun blast to the face, 13 days after she was shot to death, they charged the homeowner with second-degree murder. Wow, wow. That's pretty incredible. You go up on somebody's porch, I don't know. We of course, it's like the George Zimmerman case, in that you've killed the only other witness, so that kind of your story holds. Well, this one's going to be a little more difficult, because the homeowner Let's see, where's his name here? Theodore Wafer, W-A-F-E-R, Theodore Wafer of Dearborn Heights. The screen door was locked, and one wonders if you hear somebody pounding on your door. And we, again, don't know what happened. She was drunk. She was very, her blood alcohol level was very high, and she had been in a car accident. I forgot that Dearborn Heights and Detroit butt up against one another right there. And she walked off and then went up to this door. Her parents, Renisha McBride's parents, speculated that she was looking for help. Whatever she was doing, she was unarmed. Could she have been causing a commotion? Could she have been banging on the door? I don't know. Say you had a shotgun and someone was banging on your door wasn't it about 1:30 in the morning? So I got an idea. Let's open the door while I got my shotgun. That is not, this is another thing where guns not making anyone safer, but making us all less safe in general. So he's been arraigned on 3 charges, this Theodore Wafer, the most serious of which was murder in the second degree, and I forgot where the other charges were, probably just firearm and all that, saying he did not act in lawful self-defense, and he would turn himself in. And let's see if there's more here. I just pulled this off. This was not on the front page. At least I was looking online while I was in Dallas this weekend. And did not, did not see it all. Monica McBride told reporters she wanted to know why someone would shoot her daughter. She said, "I can't imagine in my wildest dreams what that man feared in her to shoot her in the face." Said Wafer, wearing a T-shirt and jeans, said little of his court appearance. Bond was set at $250,000. She said the prosecutor, Kim Worthy, said would not comment on allegations that race played a factor. She said the charging decision has nothing to do whatsoever with the race of the parties. Whether it becomes relevant later on, I don't know. Michigan's self-defense law states that residents have no duty to retreat while in their own homes if they have an honest and reasonable belief of imminent death or great bodily harm. Well, this...
I'm back.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
He opened the door. And,
he did.
And a lot of it's going to be about, they can say, well, she was drunk.
She was.
Yeah.
And she blew a pretty high.
Well, she didn't blow. They took it from her dead body. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. That was a mistake. Yeah. But, I mean, 1-2-1's pretty...
3 times the legal driving limit. So, you're drunk, you're black, you're in a white neighborhood, you're dead.
Yeah, simple but clearly in this case, that's what happened.
All right, your comments on that and everything else.
Deserve a shooting in the face, my God.
Kennedy assassination, got thoughts on that as well. Anybody, when we were talking about the legalization of marijuana, I used to say, I don't want to hear from anybody that thinks it should be legal. I want to hear from somebody that thinks it should remain illegal, although I don't necessarily want to hear about that now. But I
want
to...
What do you want, Peter Werby?
Someone who thinks that Lee Harvey Oswald was the sole assassin, lone assassin.
Okay.
But guess what? You know, we were talking about the government's healthcare.gov, the website,
yeah.
And just how bad it was rolled out.
Yeah.
Seems like it had a little help being bad. We'll talk about that when we get back.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night Call. Night Call. What you're supposed to do to take care of your tires by Mike Rowe. You know, I don't really know what you're supposed to do. You know who does, though? The tire experts in the service department at your Ford dealership.
Get up to $140 in mail-in rebates on 4 select tires when you use the Ford Service Credit Card. Click on the banner now. Subject to credit approval, rebates by check. Other tire manufacturer rebate or offer cannot be combined or Ford Service Credit Card rebate or offer. See your participating Ford dealer for rebate details through 12/31/13.
Do you owe the IRS? Do you have unfiled tax returns? Have you received a wage garnishment or bank levy? Maybe a lien has been filed against you. OMG Tax can help you with all your IRS tax problems. Don't wait another second. Take action now. Call my team at OMG Tax. Honest and professional, we don't make false promises. If you owe back taxes or the IRS is garnishing your paycheck, you need help now. OMG Tax can help you get your life back to normal. If you're serious about handling your tax matter, call OMG Tax now and get the peace of mind you deserve. Don't let the IRS take your next paycheck. Stop waiting and call our team at OMG Tax. OMG Tax has a straightforward, no-nonsense approach and has helped many Americans resolve their IRS nightmare. Call OMG Tax now.
Call 1-800-430-5474. That's 1-800-430-5474. 800-430-5474.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Wait, what?
Everything that rocks.
I want to hear some revolution!
Peter and Jolene, you're listening to Night Call, the Red's award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
All right, if you are ready to testify, grab the phones, 248-544-WRIF, numerically.
248-544-9743. It looks like we have a call from South Carolina. And someone wants to chime in on this lone assassin issue, I bet.
And if you want to text us, it's 4WRIF. Or not 49743. Let me see if I can find these text stuff, see if anybody has, in fact, texted us. I love Jolene, someone writes.
Oh, who is this? I love you back.
Yeah, and this
thank right, you.
Something else, which a bunch of other stuff that doesn't concern us. Okay.
It concerns rock and roll.
Yeah, before and rock and roll after us
at
2 a.m.
Yeah. Lynn Coon.
Lynn will be in. Yeah, and so there's been an arrest and the charge of murder, second-degree murder, for the killing of Renisha McBride, which has gone international in the city.
Yeah,
yeah, in the city of Dearborn Heights, adjacent to Detroit. A 19-year-old girl goes up on the porch of a homeowner.
She'd gone to like five or six houses.
Oh, had she?
Mm-hmm.
And guy shoots her in the face from a distance. So it wasn't like she was...
She got a chance to say anything?
I don't know. You would, because you know, he's going to say whatever. You know, she said, but she could say anything. All right. I want to get to your calls.
You know, what's interesting is Michael, who's on line one, his topic is new phone number. You know that I've got a hot, it's a hot button issue for me, this new phone number.
Okay.
So I wanted to hear what he has to say.
Now, one of the major complaints, well, there's two major complaints about the new government health program that's providing health care to so many millions of more people. You know, there's an estimate that since the failure, since the Republicans blocked a national health program in the early 1990s, that 500,000 people have died.
Oh, my gosh.
Because of this right-wing insistence that if you're poor, screw you.
Yeah, that's pretty much
I told you. You know, I play handball with these right-wingers against them.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, right, in this league, this handball league that I play in. And so one of them, I said, how you doing, Bob? He says, well, I still got my health insurance. Obama hasn't taken it away.
Oh, jeez, give me a break.
And I said, I agree. I got mine, too. I said, screw those poor people. And they all looked at me, and I said, that made me a good conservative now?
I love that you just never stop.
They never stop. I never bring this stuff up.
When people know what we do for a living, and especially you've been at it so long. That's the first thing most people want to do.
So me and my lefty partner beat them 3-0.
Nice job.
I think we're even in first place. I don't know. Anyway, so the two things were the website didn't work with the dam, and the other thing was that people were mad because they had these terrible health policies that didn't conform to these new standards. They could, you know, they had a lifetime cap. They could get rid of you for, like, you know, it was like old.
These were things that are not good.
Yeah, and people wanted these. I couldn't understand it. They wanted
that resistance to change.
Yeah, I guess.
And resistance is something they don't want.
So why in the world could the government not put together a decent website? Everyone's asking. Well, guess what? The right wing has been performing these, what they call denial of service, distributed denial of service, that there have been these successful attacks on the healthcare.gov, at least 16 of them, and these attacks are designed to make a network unavailable to intended users, generally through a concerted effort to disrupt service, such as repeatedly accessing the servers. saturating them with more traffic than the website is designed to handle.
And we're not talking about verbal attacks. You know, we're talking about cyber attacks.
Yeah. Right-wingers have been distributing the link to the necessary tools to perform the attacks on the healthcare.gov website through social networking, as pointed out by Information Week and other websites. The name of the attack tool is Destroy Obamacare.
Oh, that's original.
Yeah. But think about these. I mean, the desire to destroy the signature piece of legislation of the Obama administration, to weaken it so badly so it can't govern, has come to the point where they're doing this and essentially condemning more people to death and more people not to have access to health care. Destroy Obamacare, that's the advertised name given to the attack tool by right-wing patriots, as they call themselves, who are distributing this denial-of-service tool through downloads on social networks, which promises to overwhelm the healthcare.gov website. And here's what one of them said. This program continually displays alternate page of the Obamacare website. It has no virus, Trojans, worms, or cookies. The purpose is to overload the Obamacare website to deny service to
That's
users
awful.
And perhaps overload and crash the system, reads the program's grammar and spelling challenged about screen. You can, and it says, you can open as many copies of this program as you want. Each copy opens multiple links to the site. Hello. This is probably one of the major reasons why this site has not been functional.
Yeah, and I didn't even think about that. You know, that's how unconspiracy I am, or non-conspiracy that I am. I didn't even think that there would be.
No, I didn't either. This is astounding. And they say Obamacare is an affront to the constitutional rights of the people. A right-wing dominated Supreme Court held opposite, that it is in fact constitutional. And there are decisions that they make that I dislike. You know, the fact that they decided that corporations are people and have the right of free speech and can buy all these elections. But you know what? That is the law of the land. And one of the things that should be done is, as is being done, to overturn this decision is to get a constitutional amendment in. That's one of the things that's going on. To elect people who will put in more liberal Supreme Court justices and what have you. But to do this kind of thing, and it's not to the law. They're not hurting a law. I mean, they would hurt the law, and that's what they're trying to do. But what they're going to do is hurt people that are the most vulnerable, that are sick, that have lost their health insurance because of these policies they want to keep.
Yeah, people who have no faces, according to these people.
Yeah.
You know, they just have they're no face, and those people have no heart.
Yeah, yeah. And one, you know why they want to do it? Here, it says, underlying, this is New York Times, underlying fierce Republican efforts to stop President Obama's health care law and the White House drive to save it is a simple historic reality. Once major entitlement programs get underway, they quickly become embedded in American life. And then they grow. Oh, that's really horrible. What are some other really terrible things? Medicare,
right.
Social Security,
yeah.
Minimum wage. Yeah, these are terrible.
The only thing that keeps the majority of elderly people going.
Yeah, and by the way, things like Social Security and minimum wage did grow because initially, like Social Security, didn't cover all elderly people, but expanded into people with disabilities and what have you. And of course, the Republicans fought it all the way. I mean, they fought Medicare. They didn't want our seniors to have the kind of medical care that they have now. Socialized medicine, essentially, right? Government health care.
Exactly.
Man, yeah.
That includes my parents.
All right. Let's go off to South Carolina and talk to Michael. Michael, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air. Welcome. You know what? I guess I didn't do it again. Michael, hi. You're on the air. No.
Peter, what?
Oh, all right. One more time.
You've held me on.
There you go, Michael. You're on the air. Michael, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah. So long, I lost my train of thought.
He said you held him on the phone on hold for so long, he lost his train of thought.
It says up here, new phone number,
it says.
Oh, yeah. I hate it, but Gigi is my friend, and just...
You been drinking?
A little bit.
Who's Gigi?
I mean, it's all right.
It's all good.
Peter and I have a drink here and there. Who's Gigi?
She's our friend.
Okay.
Oh, well, tell her hello.
Yeah, we
hello, Gigi.
Yeah, Michael, the excitement level has got to raise significantly if we're going to continue with this call.
I love what I'm getting out of the back room. Oh, my God.
We're going to let you go to it.
He's talking about my laugh or something. I don't know.
I don't know. I think he maybe got some hooch. Don't they drink that down
they
there?
Do. They sure as heck do.
Michael, thanks for listening in South Carolina. Yeah. Here is Kevin. Kevin's in Wayne. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
I just wanted to say in relation to the whole Kennedy assassination thing, you know, a lot of people who don't believe that it was a conspiracy, I feel like they don't believe it because they just are, like, scared to believe that their government would do something like that.
I think you're right.
I just
wanted to say, like, in relation to that, you know, I mean, we have on paper, like, official documents, you know, Operation Northwood from 1961, which Kennedy threw out. He just didn't sign it or whatever.
Remind me what that is. I remember the name. I can't remember for the life of me what it is. Northwood.
Right. It was an intergovernment think tank, unelected intergovernment think tank, put together a plan to attack Cuba, and this plan included things like crashing civilian airplanes, like American citizen airplanes, over Cuba and blaming it on Castro so that they could raise support to invade Cuba.
That's right. Actually, now I do remember that as one of them.
Right.
I mean, one of the things, one of the reasons.
I mean, that's pretty juicy.
Yeah. One of the reasons that people thought it was possible that the Cuban government was behind it is because the United States government had tried to assassinate Fidel Castro numerous times. And in fact, from our interview last week with Peter Kornbluh of the National Security Archive, a non-government organization, said that at the moment of the assassination in Paris, a CIA agent was giving a Cuban CIA agent, someone working for the CIA, a poison pen, a pen that had a hypodermic in it that could inject poison.
That's so Bond.
Yeah, it is. And so people thought, well, you know, tit for tat, right? Can I say that?
Yeah, in that regard.
In that regard, yeah. So, but Cuba had absolutely nothing to do with it, and everybody realizes now that when, in fact, Peter Kornbluh said that on the interview last week, he said when Castro heard that, he said, oh, no, they're going to blame it on us.
See?
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate
thanks,
your call. Yeah, yeah. Bringing that up. All right. Back to the healthcare. I mean, can you believe that? And that
the sabotage.
The right wing.
Discussing?
The right wing is sabotaging healthcare.gov. They are launching denial of service attacks, where you get thousands and thousands of computers to demand access at the same time, and it crashes it.
And so, this is not even, you know, I don't even find this a stretch.
No.
That they're doing this now that it's come out, that they have been doing this. It's not even a stretch. It makes perfect sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, right. Now, the whole thing about what the New York Times editorial board calls a self-inflicted political wound that President Obama kept repeating, and wrongly, assertions that Americans would be able to keep their health insurance plans if they wanted under the new health care reform law. And this is for about 5% of the population. This is nothing that has to do with people who are getting it through companies. But so many of these policies were what they called junk policies that would collapse when you tried to collect on them, had enormously high deductibles.
And look how much press that one little thing got. When you told me just now that it's 5% of the population, I thought it was a lot larger.
Yeah, no. And who really did it was the insurance companies, because they were supposed to be, as it was, grandfathered in. In other words, if you had it before the law, you could keep it. But then the insurance companies rewrote the policies, and then it was no longer a grandfather policy. It was a current policy, and then they had to dump it.
Boy, they sure have ways of getting around things, don't they?
And the temporary fix allows insurers, if they choose, to reinstate canceled individual policies for a year or two instead of having them expire at the end of the year. They can extend the policies only if they first take two crucial steps. They have to inform policyholders of all the consumer protections their current policies lack, like yearly limits on a patient's out-of-pocket expenses. And I said lifetime cap. Yeah, it could be some of these policies. If you're, like, crippled for life in a car accident, it just, you
know. It only goes for so long.
Yeah.
And then, good luck.
And they all, and I don't know why people are so attached to these, because what they are, what a lot of these policyholders don't realize, they have an option to buy better policies in these exchanges with the help of federal subsidies. And the option would apply only to people who have had their current policies canceled. So, you know, again, well, here, too, there's a House Republican bill. I think this was passed, was introduced by Representative Fred Upton, the chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee, and it's intended to cripple the health insurance reform. They don't want to fix it. If there's problems with this health insurance.
They like it. They want it to get worse and worse and worse.
Yeah, that's good. The worse it is. So that's why you got these right-wingers interfering with your right to apply under this law passed by Congress, signed by the president, upheld as constitutional by the Congress.
By the Supreme Court.
I'm sorry, by the Supreme Court. You're right. And the point of opening the floodgates, allowing large numbers of people who have substandard plans and remain out of risk pools designed to keep premiums low in the healthcare exchanges, is to destroy the program. So, I don't even know if that's entirely clear. I mean, there's a lot.
There's a lot that's not entirely clear about.
Packed in there.
Yeah.
There are, this is a very complex program, and had to be because of the obstructionism of the Republicans. And essentially, they're happy. They don't call them conservatives for nothing. They want to conserve things as they are. And I haven't gone through this in a long time.
You haven't?
Yeah. But I'll be glad to do it right now. Conservatives never have come up with a good idea ever. They wanted to conserve. They're the first conservatives in the United States. They wanted to conserve our status as colonies, as you may remember. They were the Tories. They were the ones that said, oh, we should retain our status as the colonies, getting ripped off by the crown and what have you. Then they wanted to conserve slavery, right? And those are
move.
The conservatives. Then they they wanted to conserve segregation, and they wanted to conserve men only voting.
Yes, men and, only everything.
And they wanted to conserve whites only voting. And
oh,
so, wait a minute, those were Democrats in the South. Yeah, but they were conservatives.
Yes.
Yeah. And as soon as the Democratic Party lived up at all to its definition, every one of those conservative Democrats became a Republican.
It's amazing.
I mean, the Republicans really altered themselves, because with the Party of Lincoln and up until 1877, when the Republican Party sold out black people in the South and allowed this reign of terror to take place under the Democrats, they were called radical Republicans, and they had an idea of having a biracial society in which people were equal. And had their programs been allowed to come to fruition, we wouldn't be having any of the racial concerns we have now. I doubt it. We wouldn't
look at all of the years between.
We wouldn't have predominantly white suburbs. We wouldn't have predominantly black cities. It's too much. I mean, because you got to start getting class into that. And
true.
Yeah.
The one thing that you usually, from what I recall in this discussion,
yeah, there's
you
more.
Usually say, though, tell us one good thing.
that conservatives have ever put forth.
Just one.
Yeah. They want it. So now they
We got one answer.
Yeah,
one
somebody answer. Said they, I can't remember. They,
look, we can't even think of the one.
Somebody like weights and measurements or, you know, something.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it wasn't a biggie. But I'm trying to, so right now the conservatives want to conserve the American health system as it is, which richly rewards.
Which blows, by the way.
Well, okay.
Let's just be real. Brass tacks here.
Yeah, why go through details?
Why candy coat it?
Yeah, but the details are that right now the health system benefits the insurers, doctors.
Pharmaceutical companies.
Big pharma. Yeah, for sure. And who it disadvantages is people that can't afford policies. So that comes out to 40, 50, 60 million.
It's that or their jobs. Yeah. You know, they're working part-time and not getting the benefits.
Sure. So you got 40 million people without health insurance. And then you have, maybe another 40 million people with inadequate. Some of them have, work through work. The ones aren't very good. And we've said this a lot. I mean, one of the things that happens so that workers, say, at Walmart are eligible for Medicaid.
Yes.
So we are paying the health insurance of Walmart's lowly paid retail workers.
You know,
it's a scam.
How do those Waltons live with themselves?
They have art.
Oh, yes. That's
Alice.
Right. They offer art.
She's bought hundreds of millions of dollars of art and has a nice, down there in Arkansas, has a wonderful art museum.
Seriously?
Yeah.
It's just vomitous.
Yeah.
Just vomitous.
But there. It's weird you say that. I was just reading an article about words, and one of them was vomitous.
It was?
Yeah.
What did it say?
It was sort of, something was pukey.
Oh, okay. I thought it was talking about the word itself.
Yeah, well, they were talking about words that were actual words, but not used very much.
I like that one.
Yeah, vomitous. By the way, speaking of art, not everybody has paintings on their wall. A lot of people have prints.
I have a lot of black and white photography and some paintings that are not necessarily the nicest, coolest paintings.
I bet they're from friends.
It was above my grandmother's couch.
Okay.
You know, it's
or
a nice
like
little
yeah.
forest scene. And, you know, I'm into art. Like, I love going to the DIA and once in a while the galleries. I love artists.
Yeah.
You know, I would never, I know what you're leading up to, spend the amount of money ever, no matter how much money I had, on some of these expensive pieces of art that go out at the art auction house.
Well, I got to tell
never.
You, though.
Never.
You know, I only.
You have beautiful things.
But we rarely spend,
right.
They're usually a couple hundred dollars at most. And they're from people we know.
See, I wouldn't even. Well, you mean artists that you know.
Yeah.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there is something at the Center for Creative Studies.
CCS.
CCS, the old CCS, yeah. They have, if you wanted just beautiful pieces of art on your wall, you could go to the student shows, buy the stuff. I don't think they ever have anything for more than $250, and just get fabulous stuff. But, I don't know, it's sort of disconnected. You know, I mean, the art. I mean,
like you
I,
want to know the artist?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I'll draw you a picture.
Okay.
I'll only charge you 50.
What's the other source I was thinking of? So, and same thing for my parents who have passed.
Yeah,
I have
family members.
I have their
You have
art.
Some pretty cool stuff. My favorite thing in your house is the picture of that elderly woman. Who just looks so kind of classy, but smart-assy at the same time in your front room?
The
painting.
Right when you come in?
Yes.
No, that's, that's a poster.
Whatever it is, I like it.
Well, that's actually my dad's cousin who was Sarkis Sarkisian, who started the Detroit Artist Market.
Wow.
And her name was Anna Werby.
I love her.
But you know what? If you look at that closely, and I never did, I actually read about the painting. The painting itself is in the Detroit Institute of Arts at DIA.
Oh, I'm sure I've seen it there.
But it's a poster, and what it shows, one half of her face is when she was young, and the other half is when she was older.
I got to look closer.
And
right?
I always thought it was of her as an older
woman.
Yeah,
that's what I thought.
And she hated it.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
I would, if she were here, I'd tell her.
Yeah. She was quite powerful in the local art movement.
Scene? Cool.
Yeah,
but, so what, why are we talking about art?
Oh, art.
Why are we leading?
All right. So what is art, but if you think about it, it is, in terms of painting, it is paint on canvas, right?
Sure.
So what makes, and we talk about, you know, how evocative some art is and how just incredible what it portrays.
Yeah.
And sometimes I have to tell you that I'll go, like, in New York to the Museum of Modern Art.
Well, we went to a museum in D.C., National Museum?
The National Gallery.
National Gallery.
Well, some of those, though. Those were, like, some of those huge, what was it called? Like, the American School. They were, like, 24 feet long.
Unbelievable.
But I'm talking about, in some modern art, people always disparage that because anybody could do that. They just
throw. Oh, it's like they're just splashing paint on a canvas.
They were, like Jackson Pollock.
I love it.
Well, you know what? I look at Jackson Pollock, and these things are worth millions now.
Yeah.
And I have to, and, they're decent enough, but I say, that's somebody splashing paint on canvas. So where does its value come from? I mean, assessing value is pretty difficult in and of itself.
Yeah.
Because, why is something worth something one day and something different another day? Why is gold?
Sounds like Wall Street.
Yeah, well, yeah. It is just sort of, well, in a way, all value is artificial. It's sort of a sign. Like the money nuts, they say, that all money has to be backed by gold. I mean, gold has an artificially assigned value.
Yeah.
It's a rock.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's scarce. So more people want it. So we know from our high school economics, supply and demand.
Yeah.
If there's less of a supply and more of a demand, up goes the price.
Well, that's happening with silver now. I guess it's
is silver's
down.
Up now.
It's down.
Oh, yeah. Okay. And gold, I think, has dropped a little. Anyway, there's something called a triptych, which is just
what is this?
Three panels.
And it's T-R-I-P-T-Y-C-H.
Yeah, and it's pronounced triptych.
I've never heard that term. I've seen it.
A painting from 1969 by an artist named Francis Bacon. His painting of one of his buddies, Lucian Freud. I don't know any relation to the Freud, but was a painter, Lucian Freud. It sold for $142 million.
Ooh.
And you know the whole thing about the emperor wears no clothes?
Yeah.
That everybody's kind of sort of self-hypnotized in a way.
And looking away.
Kind yeah.
Of a, yeah.
Yeah. Someone says, yeah, emperor has... I wonder if he went up to this guy that said that you just spent $142 million. He'd say, you know what? It's just ink and
just paint
on canvas.
Well, it just... Wasn't it seven people who bid on this thing?
Yeah.
Seven super rich bidders, it says in this article in the New York Times.
Yeah. And then it broke the previous record set in May of last year, Edvard Munch's fabled pastel of the Scream, which most people have seen.
Most people know that one.
Yeah, if you have, because it's been used with different titles underneath it. It's that figure, how would you describe it, with this mouth wide open on a bridge?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, isn't it a white?
Can't do it with your hands.
Okay. You can describe it.
Yeah, well, that's the best I can do. But I guess that many people want it, and it's both a fetishistic accumulation.
I was going to say hoarding.
Well, you have
art hoarding,
because this has been bid up artificially or socially to it. Something that this is such a, I mean, not the one that just sold for $142 million. But the Munch, the Scream, everybody knows that. And imagine, saying you have that. But it also is a way, to put your money.
It's a way to invest.
Yeah.
It's a way to invest, and I get that. But I don't know. I mean, who has that? If I had $100 million, okay, one of the bidders, this sold in 10 minutes. It went up that high in 10 minutes. One of the bidders said, I went to a $101 million, but it hardly mattered, said Larry Gagosian, the super dealer who was trying to buy the painting on behalf of a client. I mean, who has this kind of money? If I had $101 million, I would do so many good things.
Yeah.
in this country and wherever else.
You know what? You could do good things with $100 million, and you'd have a million left over. You'd be a millionaire still.
I'd be just fine.
Yeah. I mean,
I don't need things. I don't need a bigger houses. I don't need bigger cars. In fact, in my life, I've actually gone the opposite direction, but mostly by choice. I downsized my house. Mm-hmm. I don't drive a big old SUV anymore. Thank you. You can all rest easily. Gosh, you know how much crap I got for that for so many years? Drive a hybrid. I've simplified it. Opposite direction. Who was that? Oh, I don't know.
Here's what we think. I haven't played that in a long time.
No, we haven't.
Eat the rich. Yeah.
They're eating you.
Out of the palace, into the ditch, the 1%. Actually, it's not even the 1%. 1% can't afford that. You get into the 1%. There's so few people in this country with lots of money that if you're making $375,000 a year, you're in the 1%.
Yes.
Yeah. But we're talking about the 0.1%.
Yeah, we're talking about the fattest cats of all fat cats up there. I mean, you know. We know people who have money.
Peter. Same thing here. Early Phillips auction draws solid sales for contemporary pieces. So these are artists I've never even heard of, and they're, well, some of them. Lichtenstein, what's his first name? It's here somewhere. I should know that. But Andy Warhol, and also, doesn't appear to be here.
Okay.
Anyway, Lichtenstein, he did Woman with Peanuts, a 1960.
Oh, God, I thought you were going to say something else.
Control yourself.
Carry on.
Yeah, yep, yep. I want to know, how could they just toss Lichtenstein's name? And I know what it is.
Maybe that because he's
No. They never would do that. But anyway, a 1962 image taken from a newspaper ad and is expected to sell for $10 million to $15 million.
Wow.
Yeah. And
Woman with Peanuts.
Okay. Let's take a break. It's time to do that. We're going to throw cold water on you.
This is our final segment coming up. So.
Yeah, and we get into our Department of Religion. Sarah Palin on Pope Francis.
She's not digging the new pope.
No, and George W. Bush, he's got a new crusade.
Oh, yeah.
Back with that after these.
Make your opinion heard. Call us at our new number, 248-544-WRIF. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night call.
This next song goes out to someone real special. Web developers. You've developed a World Wide Web of convenience, and Geico.com is eternally grateful. Now everyone can pay bills, manage policies, maybe save big money on car insurance, all from the comfort of their desk chairs, recliners, and water beds. You're magicians with wands made of binary code, and that's why we're sending this next song out to you. For a free rate quote, visit Geico.com.
Hey, music lovers. Tired of your music buffering while you're running around? Here's a reality check. Verizon's 4G LTE is the most reliable and in more places than any other 4G network. Reliability you can believe in. That's powerful. Verizon. Click on the banner to compare the maps.
Business owners, do you want to double your sales in 12 months? Chet Holmes International's track record for the past 3 decades speaks for itself. Our legendary founder and best-selling author of The Ultimate Sales Machine, Chet Holmes explains.
Why does one person open a business and you go back 30 years later and basically they've made themselves a job, not a business? Another person opens up a business and in 10 years they have 60 locations and cash out a multimillionaire. The difference between the two is not the product or the service, folks. It's the skills and learning curve of the entrepreneur.
We've created a serious training program. 4 ways to double sales in 12 months. And we'll give this to any serious business owner who calls 800-936-0222. Leave us a voicemail with your email to get this powerful audio training program at our expense. Call right now. It's a heck of a gift. See if you agree. 800-936-0222. That's 800-936-0222. From Chet Holmes International to your success.
My mom is my hero. She goes into burning buildings. She finds people inside who need to be saved. She helps them get out, even when she can't breathe or see or is a little scared. My mom is a firefighter, but the best thing she can do is come home.
The U.S. Fire Administration reminds you to protect yourself and firefighters. Have smoke alarms on every level and near sleeping areas. Test them monthly. Change batteries as instructed. Install sprinklers. Do your part to get out before firefighters have to come in. The fact is, most fire deaths occur in homes with no working smoke alarms. The good news is, that's a fact we can change. Smoke alarms save lives. Find out more at usfa.dhs.gov.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much. It's our final segment, so if you want to comment, 248-544-WRIF, which
248-544-9743.
Lots happening on Facebook, facebook.com/nightcall. We always like likes, and you can see some photographs of me in Dealey Plaza just matter of hours ago.
Not just you hanging at the park.
yeah. Down in Dallas, I just came back from Dallas, and visiting a federal prisoner. Did you put that up there? Did you put...
Did you put underneath as a comment.
The supportmariemason.org?
I did.
Okay, that's there. That's the federal prisoner. Marie Mason, you can... I already told the story earlier. If you want to know about it, just go there. Or at my website also, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. And since we're coming up on the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy... Yeah, this is really an interesting interview. Jolene says, I always say, I know this doesn't sound interesting.
But this one, you're going to give us the thumbs up, Peter?
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's by Lamar Waldron, The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination. It names New Orleans mafia boss Carlo Marcello as the chief conspirator of the plot that killed President Kennedy. And it is going to be made into a movie by Leonardo DiCaprio and also Robert De Niro.
With that name.
Yeah, I don't know. Leonardo DiCaprio.
Okay.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, you know what? You know a lot of other really important things. So
yes.
We're going to forgive you.
Also, Carla Kaplan, she's written a book called Miss Anne in Harlem, The White Women of the Black Renaissance. And this was also called the Harlem Renaissance. Took place in the 1920s. So all these artists and poets, people maybe the best known, Langston Hughes, and these white upper class women broke social conventions of the era and the color barrier.
Yeah.
And they played this role in this incredible cultural movement.
I love that. Yeah. Now I'm excited about that,
okay.
Peter.
That's good. I want to tell you about, let me get this. We haven't been taking many of your calls, so I want to tell you about Mayor Ford and Ford Motors of, first of Toronto.
Mayor Ford.
But also
of
what
Toronto.
George Bush has been doing and Sarah Palin, not our faves. Here's, James in Auburn Hills. James, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
You were mentioning earlier about how they have this website that can knock down that website.
No, yeah. Well,
it's something you can do called denial of service.
Yeah.
Right. And what I'm just wondering is, all right, I mean, we're supposed to be, you know, I don't know. Why don't we just remove that site? Why can't we, like, block it like they do with other sites? I know plenty of internet services do not allow you to go to certain sites. So why can't they just add this as one of the excluded, you know?
Well, it could be a situation where we're talking about people who are, what's the word, where they are...
Techies.
Well, yeah, but there's a word for when they
denial
go
of,
in and mess with websites.
Oh, hackers.
Thank you. My God, it was just, woo, not there. I think this is a hacking situation on some levels, and so they don't really... Sometimes you can't control the hack, man.
Well, I'll tell you this, James, this could be why there are so many problems with the healthcare.gov site, but this should have been anticipated. I mean, their good designers know that there may be attacks. But I don't know. Hey, they've gotten in, hackers have gotten into all these major sites, including the Pentagon and big corporations. And if you think about Anonymous, this group that has hacked any number of sites, You know, maybe it's not so easy to defend at all. But, you know, this is a little beyond my pay grade, so let me put it out there and see if other people want to comment. So thank you very much. By the way, a man named Jeremy Hammond, H-A-M-M-O-N-D, on Friday was sentenced to 10 years in prison. He was a hacker with the group Anonymous,
yeah,
the people that wear those Guy Fawkes masks.
Yeah.
He just got 10 years in prison for being part of who hacked Strafford, which is this intelligence firm that was then, the stuff that he got was leaked to WikiLeaks.
Oh!
10 years in prison.
10 years.
That's cold.
And Julian Assange is out there he's just chilling.
Yeah.
In asylum.
In the embassy of...
Isn't he in South
Uruguay?
America?
Yeah. No, he's in the embassy in London.
He's in London.
He can't leave he can never go out of the Uruguayan, if it is Uruguay. It's either, yeah, it must be, it's Uruguay. Uruguayan embassy.
He's under house arrest, basically.
Well, yeah. I mean, there was...
They could probably sneak a lady in there for him.
Or sneak him out in a laundry basket.
Yeah,
during the 1940s or 50s, there was a Hungarian archbishop that was in the U.S. embassy like for 12 years because the communists wanted to arrest him.
Gosh.
Speaking of religion, let's do Mayor Ford first.
Okay.
Toronto Mayor Rob Ford admitted during a heated...
You say it slower. Toronto. Toronto.
Toronto.
Toronto, Canada,
Toronto.
Mayor, this
yeah,
is juicy
Rob
stuff.
Rob Ford admitted during this, you all may know of this, because I'm saying y'all because I just got back from Dallas.
Oh, please don't do it.
No, I hate that. So this was a national news. During a heated city council debate on Wednesday, he said he had bought illegal drugs in the past 2 years.
And it was crack, and it was because he was really drunk.
Yeah, well, he said he had used it because, because he was in a drunken stupor.
He was in a drunken stupor, and he needed to snap out of it.
Yeah. his former allies, a counselor, like a council member, he had publicly acknowledged last week that he smoked crack cocaine while in a drunken stupor last year, but his comments Wednesday marked the first time he acknowledged buying illegal drugs.
I mean, come on, who hasn't? And when you're in a drunken stupor, like, what was our friend who just called from South Carolina? He's probably on the line trying to get himself some crack cocaine right now.
Are you saying who hasn't been in a drunken stupor?
I'm just joking. And bought crack.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, right. All right, Denzel Minnan Wong, who was a longtime ally, asked him, had he bought illicit narcotics in the past 2 years? And I saw this, and he hesitated, and then he said, yes, I have.
Yes, yeah. I have.
All right, so many of you know this, but did you know, I mean, so who would support this guy? He's got all these...
People who don't think there should be any drug laws?
Maybe. But how about this? Do you know what his supporters call themselves? Ford Nation. His name is Rob Ford.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So they call themselves Ford Nation.
And he's got a logo that looks like
the
Ford logo.
Oh, yeah, so the Ford Motor Company says it's going to protect its script, you know, the logo. And it said that Ford Nation incorporating the automaker's logo at a United Way charity event, according to the National Post newspaper from Toronto. Let's see. Ford did not grant permission for use of its logo, said a company spokesman. We view it as an unauthorized use of our trademark and have asked to have it stopped. I mean, particularly for, you know, a crackhead. You don't want a crackhead
well,
using
I don't
your
think
logo.
If you do it once, you're not really a crackhead, are
no,
you?
I know. Well, you can call it. When it's a politician, you can do it.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, he said that there are many council members there in Toronto who are on drugs. They all know stories about each other, but he's not a rat.
Well, that's why. You're right, because the overwhelming majority of people who try or use crack do not get addicted, don't become crackheads.
But if you do, it is an ugly smell
it's
to be.
Dangerous.
I know
dangerous.
Some people who've
very, very dangerous. All right.
Bit by that demon.
Let's go on to some of our least favorite people on the planet. Why
sounds,
is he doing
sounds
this?
Enjoyable.
George W. Bush, you may remember him. He started a couple wars that have essentially and cut
Changed
taxes
our
on the rich,
economy.
Tanked the economy,
yeah.
And
that's
all these people killed and all that.
Yeah, that's all.
Some people think George W. Bush did as much as he could to bring about Armageddon with his earlier interventions in the Middle East, it says here in Alternet. but not the man, himself, apparently. He has signed up for a fundraising event for the Messianic Jewish Bible Institute, an organization which aims to promote the second coming by converting Jews to Christianity, and will speak today. That was, that would have been Thursday, at their fundraiser in Irving, Texas. I could have made it.
It's right there. It's very wealthy, Irving.
Yeah, man.
Now, could have made it, please, Peter. Is this Jews for Jesus?
I don't know.
Okay.
You know, there is a Jews for Jesus thing. You know,
one of my good friends' dad is a Jew for Jesus.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, for an odd reason, which I don't want to give the name because then I would give it. Our phone has listed under someone's name with a Jewish last name.
Do you still have that name?
I don't know. Maybe I think it is still. So every once in a while, we get these calls. You know, I say hello, and they say, do you know that Jesus was a Jew? And I went, what? What are you talking about? And they go on with this. And
someone
said,
told me that.
And I said, dude, you're out of here. You know, goodbye. But this is terrible.
It's terrible because,
the
headline is right. Terrible. It says it all. George W. Bush's new crusade converting Jews to Christianity.
How about new crusade? Remember what his last crusade was? He said it was Iraq.
Oh, that went well, huh?
And that's what they call, that's in their, you know, the Muslims were saying, you know, this is the crusaders have returned. Now, actually, I don't care about this at all, other than just to show their utter stupidity and hypocrisy and what have you. I mean, they can...
bloated sense of self.
Yeah, and no boundaries.
Righteousness.
No boundaries.
No.
This rich kid that they could start wars.
He was never taught boundaries, clearly. Right. And, yeah. You know, carries on into his adult life into a way that people are dying.
He did a lot of cocaine. He
snorted half a Peru, thank you.
Anyway, Messianic Jews who accept that Jesus was the promised Messiah are loathed by most other Jews and regarded with great suspicion by mainstream Christian denominations.
This is definitely Jews for Jesus.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I couldn't care about any of this other than how crazy they all are. If Jesus really was the promised Messiah, this would restore much of the traditional basis for Christian anti-Semitism, which most Christians have struggled against for the last 50 years. Why would this? Oh, I see. Because that would mean they were the Christ killers. But they had to kill him. I mean, listen, if God is omniscient, all-seeing, right?
Yeah.
He knew all. Why is he doing this? He knows all this is going to happen, right? He knew there was going to be a fall from grace because so why did he create these people? And no, because even before he created them, Adam and Eve, he knew they were going to fall. Right?
Yeah.
So does that constitute free will? I don't think so.
Is it teaching people a lesson? Is that what that's all
Why
about?
Was there even any people? And where did they all come from?
Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve.
But then, all right. So I don't even know. I didn't follow it. So they got kids? Adam and Eve had kids?
I don't know.
Okay.
No, you're asking the wrong woman.
Right, let's get out of this.
You know more about it than I do.
Let's get out of this. Hey, I have some of these. I told you, I play handball with these right-wingers, and most of them are kind of like right-wing Catholics. And I was pleased. They like Pope Francis.
Yeah,
but Sarah Palin, her voice has just gotten worse and worse, by the way.
You mean how she, like her voice?
She's at it again with another verbal diatribe, but this time it's been directed at Pope Francis.
It's verbal diarrhea.
Yeah. Last night, an interview with CNN, the former half-term Alaskan government revealed her religious concern over the Pope's liberal ideology. You know what his liberal ideology is, folks? He's concerned about the poor.
I know. How dare he?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. What an awful man.
Yeah. So she, let me see. Where is her
She
quote?
Said he's had some statements that, to me, sound kind of liberal.
Yeah.
Has taken me aback. Has kind of surprised me. You know how she can't, as I'm trying to form an entire sentence myself, she really cannot form an entire sentence.
No.
Sentence. It's all in just little pieces.
Some of these Catholics have called Pope Francis a self-styled revolutionary. I always wonder about that phrase, self-styled. Yeah. Or they say self-defined or self-called or so-called, you know.
Yeah.
All those little, but self-styled. I mean, as opposed to what? You get appointed by
yeah,
the
right.
by the World Revolutionary Council?
Hey, wait a minute. Someone is thinking for themselves, not yeah. the institution necessarily, or for the betterment of that said institution, if you want to go that route.
Because, you know, this isn't true as well. Pope Francis has come under criticism by many American Catholics, I would say some, for his particularly open-minded comments about a number of social issues from homosexuality and abortion to contraception. Actually, what he said is that this is not what should define the Catholic Church.
Right. That he said that the Church is too obsessed with certain social issues.
Right.
I can just really dig this.
Yeah, yeah. It therefore comes as no surprise that Palin, an avid Tea Party movement supporter whose members have traditionally been opposed to gay marriage and abortion, would be, quote, taken aback by the Pope's liberal point.
You know, Sarah Palin, I don't care what you think.
Yeah, I guess not.
It's amazing how much press she gets. She just opens her mouth and
boom. She's sort of out of it, and because I never used to like to give her any publicity. Like, remember, and she's still prominent, this woman.
We would call her She Who Shall Not Be Named.
Yeah, or didn't we call her, there was someone else we called the right-wing bitch from hell.
Yeah, that was AC.
Yeah, right.
And who's on TV, not the radio.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
We love AC here.
I saw her with Bill Maher.
Oh, yeah.
Did you see that?
I think they're totally doing it here and there. Mm-hmm.
They go out?
I think they've done it.
Why?
The dirty deed.
Why? Smoking? No.
No, because I think he has this is me projecting.
Yeah.
I think that Bill Maher has this fantasy about, you know, laying her down and changing her ways.
He asked her, he says, people always ask me, do you really believe what you say? And she says, why do people always ask me that?
Yeah, because she's so whacked.
Yeah.
I mean, she seriously is whacked.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Well, people might not even know who we're talking about.
Bill Maher, most people know who has, you know, show on HBO. And Ann Coulter is the right-wing bitch from hell. What else do we need to say?
Yeah, she, boy, the names of her, you know, talk about demonization. And, you know, some people might say, well, look, you've demonized conservatives.
Everyone we have?
Yeah.
Really?
Oh, you know.
I think we're just telling the truth.
They're demons.
they must be demonized.
Yeah, they can demonize.
Yeah, she's the one that, I think she gets away with a lot of this crap because some people consider her to be relatively good looking and that her looks help, you know, it's like, oh, well, she, at least, you know, these guys, oh, she's hot, you know, who cares what she says?
You know what?
I don't find her attractive
in
the least.
Yeah, you know, I don't get it. If Ann Coulter and Sarah Palin were like left-wingers or progressives,
yeah,
you would think they were attractive.
I don't know, Peter. I can't even go there.
Well, we've talked about over the years about people that have partners, spouses, girlfriends, boyfriends of different political persuasions.
I don't know how they do it.
Neither do I. I mean, I'm sorry this is going to probably offend some people, but I mean, I actually...
You would never do such a
thing. I know, and I feel badly. I actually feel a little badly saying this to the listeners. That, I mean, I can, you know, that the conservative ideology, I think, is this severe character flaw.
I know you think that.
And the idea that, you know...
You think there's some sort of psychosis going on.
And, you know, well, if I was single... I don't know.
I think it's greed and money, you know, which can lead to that kind of psychosis.
I don't even think it's greed and money.
You don't?
No. I think it's just this authoritarian personality. I think it's...
I agree with that part.
This punitive, you know, sort of thrust that punish those that haven't made it successfully, you know.
Isn't that sad?
Yeah.
If that is so. I mean, I think there is some definitely... modicum of truth to all that, Peter.
Well, if we had any time, we would let conservatives defend themselves. Unfortunately, we're out of it.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I've had a long day. I started off.
You have.
I started off in Dallas at about 6:30 in the morning.
And now you're in Detroit at 1 a.m.
And if you want to see some of my adventures, you can go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/nightcall. Photographs, pardon me, of me in Dealey Plaza, where President Kennedy was shot 50 years ago, almost.
I'm surprised you've never been there before.
I've never been to Dallas other than the Dallas airport when, you know.
What about Texas?
Never been to Texas, either.
Well, see, that's okay,
I went through Texas. When I was 20 years old, I took a bus from Detroit to Mexico City.
Did you really?
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Oh, no, I've been on a bus. I took a bus from Brownsville, Texas, to Mexico City, to Monterey, and then to Mexico City, and I was with the people of Mexico.
That's pretty far.
And I know. It was long.
But Detroit to Mexico City.
Oh, my God. What were you doing?
Were you chasing after
a lady?
No.
Oh, wait, no, you were the same one you're with now.
Yeah. I was going to go to school to Mexico City College.
What?
That had some arrangement with Michigan State University.
What were you going to study?
Same thing I was studying up at Michigan State.
Liberal arts?
Yeah. Drinking and chasing. Yeah. All right.
You excelled, Peter.
Are we on the air?
We're almost off the
air. Yeah, we are. All right. Okay.
Thank you to Jefferson for answering our phones tonight.
And everybody stay safe. I hope people have their electricity. And of course,
and
if they don't, you're not listening to us.
Don't go near them. Well, some people have battery-operated radios.
Yeah, there are people that they got their crank radio
hear us. When I lost it in the divorce, I hate to say, but I had this wind-up crank-up. It was a modern radio.
So do we.
Yeah.
And it's also, you can charge your cell phone.
See, that's very smart.
Yeah, you can, it's got a flashlight on it. It's got a red flasher.
Yeah, especially for the dedicated night call listener in storm times of stormy times.
Well, I'm going to go home and see if we have any electricity.
Peter, don't even say it, because I live two blocks from you.
You do. Yeah. All right, we'll talk next week. Thanks for joining us, and stay tuned for, we got Lamar Waldron talking about, who was responsible for the death of John F. Kennedy.
And a podcast available tomorrow.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Night Call on 101 The Riff. We'll return with more Night Call right after this. Night Call. Night Call. Night Call. Night Call.
Do you owe the IRS? Do you have unfiled tax returns? Have you received a wage garnishment or bank levy? Maybe a lien has been filed against you. OMG Tax can help you with all your IRS tax problems. Don't wait another second. Take action now. Call my team at OMG Tax. Honest and professional, we don't make false promises. If you owe back taxes or the IRS is garnishing your paycheck, you need help now. OMG Tax can help you get your life back to normal. If you're serious about handling your tax matter, call OMG Tax now and get the peace of mind you deserve. Don't let the IRS take your next paycheck. Stop waiting and call our team at OMG Tax. OMG Tax has a straightforward, no-nonsense approach and has helped many Americans resolve their IRS nightmare. Call OMG Tax now.
Call 1-800-430-5474. That's 1-800-430-5474. 800-430-5474.
Hey, Larry, mind if I sit down?
Nope.
This coffee tastes like coffee. So what's going on?
Not much.
What's new?
Not much.
Okay, but can you please put the newspaper down while you say not much?
What newspaper?
This newspaper. Oh, dude, what happened to your face? I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Ow.
Dude, what is this? 11 pieces of toilet paper stuck to your face?
I'm shaving in the dark to save energy. I'm helping the environment.
That's a dangerous way to help the environment.
Well, sometimes you have to sacrifice yourself for the greater good.
Dude, there's an easier and safer way to help the environment without sacrificing yourself. Go green, go public. Take public transportation. It's good for the environment, and you won't have to live behind a newspaper.
Wow.
But for now, put the newspaper back up.
A message from the public transportation systems across the country. To learn more, visit publictransportation.org.
101 WRIF.
That's perfect.
Everything that rocks. We'll be right back.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Oh, you're on!
The Riff. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. The Night Call is back on 101 WRIF. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Remember, you may remember, hopefully some of you listen every week, that I interviewed Peter Kornbluh. He had written an article called The Darkest Day for Cigar Aficionado, about a strange Cuban connection to the assassination of President Kennedy. Not that the Cubans were behind it, but at that particular time, right at the moment of the assassination, there was an envoy from the Kennedy administration in Havana talking about improving relations between the two countries. But one thing that struck me peculiar was Peter Kornbluh thinks that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin. And I said, well, I'm always glad to get minority opinions on the air, because according to an Associated Press recent poll, 59% of us believe that there was a conspiracy, while only 24% accepts the Warren Commission conclusion that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. And what I'm reading from in the New York Times book review section, Gregory Cowell says he knows that adds up to only 99%, but the other 1% probably think that President Obama was behind it, although he was only a year or so old. Those of you with a good memory for this show remember a wonderful guest we had on a while ago, Lamar Waldron. He wrote a book called The Legacy of Secrecy about the Kennedy assassination, and pinned it on the mafia, because there's a lot of speculation. I think most people, if you ask them, it must have been the CIA. Some people say the Cubans, right-wing oil guys. But Lamar Waldron nails it, names the man behind it, mafia godfather Carlos Marcello. And he's got a brand new book out called The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination, The Definitive Account of the Most Controversial Crime of the 20th Century. We're reaching Lamar Waldron. Oh, Lamar, welcome back. But I forgot, where are we reaching? In Georgia somewhere, right?
I'm in the northern suburbs of Georgia. That's correct.
Oh, good. Of Atlanta.
That's right.
Yeah, good. Well, welcome back. And this is a done deal. You name the man that was behind the assassination of John F. Kennedy on November 22nd, 1963. So it's the 50th anniversary. And you were telling me before the show that there's sort of a bookend here, because the 50th anniversary is next Friday as well.
That's correct. It falls on a Friday, the 50th anniversary this year, just as it did in 1963.
Yeah.
And yeah, Carlos Marcello, the mafia godfather of Louisiana and most of Texas, I mean, he not only did it, him and Bobby Kennedy investigated privately and determined that Marcello did it, and told, you know, his close associate, Richard Goodwin, that Marcello did it, but the House Select Committee on Assassinations, which was the fifth of six government committees. There wasn't just one, the Warren Commission. There were six. The fifth was the House Select Committee on Assassinations in 1979, after a much longer investigation, much more thorough than the Warren Commission, had access to much more information than the Warren Commission had. They officially concluded, this is Congress, that JFK was likely killed by a conspiracy, and that Carlos Marcello and his close partner in crime, Tampa godfather Santo Trafficante, had, quote, the motive, means, and opportunity to assassinate President Kennedy. Now, what no one has really ever fully known before, I mean ever, until this new book, The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination, is that not only did Marcello confess when he was in prison in 1985 in front of two witnesses, and that was in the last book I did with Tom Hartman, Legacy of Secrecy, that's being turned into a movie by Leonardo DiCaprio and Robert De Niro. But what's brand new in this new book that I didn't have back then, I hadn't really had a chance to talk to the FBI informant that Marcello had confessed to, who was Marcello's cellmate, who, unknown to Carlos Marcello, was an informant for the FBI, and unknown to Marcello, when the informant had given Marcello a transistor radio as a present, because Marcello liked to listen to music, the transistor radio, of course, was bugged. And there was a court-authorized bug in Carlos Marcelo's federal prison cell in Texarkana Federal Correctional Institute in 1985. And even though Marcelo's main JFK confession was in the prison yard to the FBI informant, whose name was Jack Van Lanningham, and to another inmate as well that Marcelo trusted, that night in the cell, Marcelo said a few additional things, basically warning Jack not to talk about, you know, the confession he heard from Marcelo, and that was recorded on tape by the FBI. But 2 days later, Jack Van Lanningham, as you or I, once he heard Marcelo confess that he had ordered JFK's assassination, he wanted to know more, and he was able to gently nudge Marcelo in that direction a couple of nights later when they were in the prison cell with the recording going, so the FBI has got all this on tape, and Marcelo pretty much explained to Jack Van Lanningham exactly how he did it and who the real shooters were.
Well, now that actually answers one of the questions I was going to ask you, Lamar Waldron, which, why don't we just think, oh, he was just bragging? I mean, how do we because a confession often has this sort of sense of a legal confession, but he's just, well, why wasn't he just bragging to someone in prison?
Well, he would brag in the prison yard about various things. Marcelo was practically running the prison. He was so powerful. He had press clothes, special food, liquor on special occasions, controlled all of the job assignments for the inmates, had most of the prison staff, not all, most playing up to him. So, yeah, so Marcelo was not above bragging, but this kind of thing is something he would only say to someone. He had come to see Jack Van Lanningham almost like a surrogate son. And the other witness he was with when he confessed in the prison yard in a place they called the gazebo, that all the other inmates stayed away unless Mr. Marcelo invited you there. The other man had worked for Marcelo's brother in New Orleans, so he would only ever have blurted this out. Again, probably helped the fact he was 75, you know, to two people he had really trusted. But as I said, when Bobby Kennedy did his own secret investigation, Bobby Kennedy determined it was Carlos Marcelo. When the United States Congress did their investigation, they determined, and then I was able to take Marcelo's statements to Jack Van Lanningham, whom I interviewed dozens of times, and I was able to find an amazing amount of independent corroboration for what Marcelo said. So This isn't like an idle boast or somebody confessing for money. You know, Marcelo, you know, basically warned Jack twice to never talk about this or, you know, quote, the grass would grow over him.
Now, all of this is contained in Lamar Waldron's brand-new book, The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination, the definitive account of the most controversial crime of the 20th century. And you can go to thehiddenhistoryofthejfkassassination.com, and there'll be all the information about it. Also, on my website, peterwerby.com, I'll have a link directly to it. In the book, Lamar Waldron names Mafia Godfather Carlos Marcelo. I was giving him Marcello. I was giving him the, but okay. It's,
Which is the Italian
way
to pronounce it.
I know. It occurs to me sometimes, you know, I'm such a print guy that I always, you know, I read stuff, but be that what it may. So you talk about the Congressional Committee that in 1979 said that Marcelo had the motive, means, and opportunity to assassinate President Kennedy. Let's go through it. Motive. You would think, on the face of it, this would be the worst thing that a criminal organization could do because it would bring such heat on him, although it didn't. Why? So what was the motive here?
Well, John and Robert Kennedy both came to prominence in the late 50s, going after the mafia in general and Carlos Marcelo and his allies in particular. In other words, JFK presented himself as a mob buster. They hauled Carlos Marcelo, who, unlike the big New York, you know, godfathers people are familiar with, like John Gotti, who liked a lot of publicity, Marcelo was able to rule unquestioned for decades because he stayed out of the public limelight. So when John and Robert Kennedy drag him in front of those TV cameras for these highly publicized hearings, I mean, that was just awful to him. Also, not the least of which, because he was not a U.S. citizen. And that was known, and somehow during the Eisenhower-Nixon administration, you know, this guy who was not a citizen, who should have been deported, you know, was running one of the biggest criminal empires in America. So unlike most politicians, I have to say, when John and Robert Kennedy were elected, they kept their campaign promise to go after the mafia. So they went after Carlos Marcello. They went after his ally in the French Connection heroin network, Santo Trafficante. They went after Trafficante and Marcello's mutual ally, Jimmy Hoffa, who let them use the Teamsters pension fund like a piggy bank, you know, for Las Vegas and places. So the Kennedys were going after the mafia hard. They briefly deported Marcello to Guatemala, of all places, where Marcello had a fake birth certificate. Marcello got kicked out of Guatemala, was, you know, trudging through the jungle. So you've got America's most powerful godfather in April of 61, trudging through the Central American jungle in his Gucci loafers. And Marcello was a short, extremely stout man, you know, and he's in these tailored clothes, and he's just, you know, he's falling down ravines. He's just cursing his lawyers with him, you know, eternal vengeance on the people that brought him that low. Sneaks back into the country. Kennedy's mounted at that time the largest war on organized crime America had ever seen and really has ever seen. And so they were going after these mobsters in a way no one ever had before. I don't mean two or three times as much as the Eisenhower-Nixon administration. I mean 10 times and increasing. And Carlos Marcello, during almost the entire month of November, was on trial on federal charges with one of Bobby's federal prosecutors, whom I talked to in New Orleans. So remember, even a small conviction on Marcello gets him deported. They were also especially targeting Santo Trafficante in Tampa, who was really the architect of the French Connection heroin network in America. They were also targeting the Chicago Mafia, which was at that time run by Sam Giancana. Giancana's number one lieutenant in Las Vegas and Hollywood was Johnny Roselli. So all of these mobsters really, and where did they have to go? They didn't have Cuba to go back to anymore. Castro had made sure of that. And the very week JFK was killed, there was a big series of articles in the New York Times leaked from Bobby Kennedy's Justice Department talking about how the Justice Department was getting ready to go into Las Vegas and run the mafia out of Las Vegas. So the mafia had nowhere to go. Their backs were against the wall. This was true for all mobsters in general, but those three mob families in particular. So Marcello and Trafficante had been planning for a year to kill JFK, not to kill Bobby Kennedy. That's what Jimmy Hoffa wanted to do. But as Carlos Marcello explained to an earlier FBI informant back in 1962, if you kill Bobby Kennedy, JFK will just send the army in after you. The mob had already done something sort of like that in Alabama in 1954, killed the attorney general-elect. And one of the few things Eisenhower did against organized crime, he did send the National Guard into Phoenix City, Alabama, to run them out of that town where they had killed, the mob had assassinated the attorney general-elect of Alabama. But as Marcello explained to this other FBI informant, you know, if you kill JFK, then Bobby's role as the second most powerful man in America is over. It's done. That's it. You know, because everyone knew, you know, who was politically savvy at all, knew that Robert Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson hated each other.
Well, Amara, let's do this. You know, here's what I'm fearful of. This is so complex. There are so many players. There are so many things to affirm and refute in the hidden history of the JFK assassination, the name of your most recent book. I'd like to strip some of this down. I mean, I usually don't have a lot of notes. I got more notes than usual. And let's continue on with the congressional investigation of JFK's murder. The House Select Committee on Assassination said that the mafia godfather, Carlos Marcello, had the motive, and you discussed that, the means and the opportunity to assassinate President Kennedy. So the first question I would ask, because so many people, including my last week's guest, researcher Peter Kornbluh, said that the lone assassin was Lee Harvey Oswald, which is the official history, although 60% of the Americans, only, but put it another way, only 24% of American people believe that was the case. I forgot, by the way, there's 16% say they don't know. Was Lee Harvey Oswald involved in this, according to the research in your most recent book?
Naval intelligence, you know, because Oswald was supposedly an ex-Marine, naval intelligence did their own secret investigation of JFK's murder after the assassination. As you might expect, they would. since Oswald was supposedly a former Marine. And I say supposedly former because there's a big question about that. And naval intelligence officially concluded Oswald was incapable of doing the actual shooting and incapable of masterminding the assassination. Now, that really doesn't leave much role for Oswald in killing John F. Kennedy. Now, naval intelligence had access to a lot of information the Warren Commission didn't have. They had access to a lot of information the House Select Committee on Assassinations didn't have. In fact, the House Select Committee tried to get a copy of this naval intelligence investigation, and they were completely stonewalled. I mean, they found out it existed. They found out some of what it said. They talked to a pilot who had flown the investigators around. But when Tom and Hartman and I began researching all this on the 25th anniversary of JFK's murder in 88, we said, okay, here's what the House Select Committee found. Let's look at the areas where they were stonewalled. And they were stonewalled by several agencies. And so I was able to find one of those actual naval intelligence investigators. By the way, they're still all under secrecy oath, so I had to talk to him through an intermediary. I talked to another guy who actually saw the report, a separate guy. So we've got independent verification here. And naval intelligence, as you might guess, once Oswald returned from the Soviet Union with his Soviet wife, they had him under tight surveillance all that time. You know, we know now, thanks to the Senate Church Committee of the mid-70s, there was a huge domestic surveillance apparatus in America in the 50s and 60s. I mean, we have domestic surveillance today. It was massive then, FBI, CIA, military intelligence. If you were remotely left-wing or liberal, you or your group, chances are there was a file on you. And if you were really, communist, socialist, whatever, there was a big file on you.
Well, did Lee Harvey Oswald fire a shot, in your estimation?
Well, I support our men and women in uniform, and if naval intelligence says he didn't fire a shot, he was incapable of doing the shooting, I'll go with that, because, in fact, there's a tremendous amount of evidence that he didn't. The one person who saw Oswald enter the Texas School Book Depository that morning said he had nothing with him. You know, his there was nothing in his hands. So it's not like he took a rifle into that building. The package he took to work that morning was much too short to have been the disassembled rifle. And there are two witnesses, the man who drove him and that man's sister who saw Oswald in the package. So, yeah, Oswald took a package with him to work that day. It wasn't a rifle. It could not have been the Mannlicher Carcano. It was simply the package was too small physically. He couldn't have held it that way. And he took nothing into the building. So what Carlos Marcello did in prison, he explained to Jack Van Lanningham, he imported two professional hitmen from Europe. They came from Italy into Canada. They came from Canada through Michigan. And then 10 days before the assassination, they were at Carlos Marcello's huge, many thousands of acres, Churchill Farms estate outside of New Orleans, doing target practice. So during the week, Marcello was in trial, facing, you know, Bobby's federal charges. And on the weekend, you know, he's at his you know, huge multi-thousand acre estate with his pilot, David Ferry. There was a private airstrip on the estate there. You know, while the guys are doing target practice, then those guys go to a restaurant in Dallas that was run by Marcello's number two lieutenant in Dallas. They go to Dealey Plaza. They're two of the people doing the actual shooting. They go back to that restaurant, and then within a couple of days, they go back to Michigan, back to Canada. Frankly, Marcello didn't say what happened to them. He didn't tell that to Jack. I would be really shocked if they weren't murdered. Mm. You know,
sure.
Because,
well,
why would you want to have those guys left alive? And in fact, I found independent corroboration from an entirely different source. This is on the record stuff from somebody involved with Jimmy Hoffa's murder that Marcello liked to get war orphans from Italy, Sicily in particular, because they would have no relatives. So that way, once they did the hit, Marcello could rub out the hitmen, and there's literally nobody to mourn them or miss them.
You know, Lamar, in Mark Lane's film, Rush to Judgment, there is a part at which Lee Harvey Oswald is apprehended by the Dallas police, and someone says, "Why did you kill the president?" And he says, "Oh, so I'm the patsy." What? Is there a connection there? Was Oswald?
Well, that's exactly what he was. Oswald was a low-level intelligence operative for naval intelligence and the CIA. Ask yourself this: Warren Commission nobody could ever find any motive for Oswald to kill JFK. Any motive you've ever seen in the movie or documentary is simply made up. There is no motive. Warren Commission said, well, he was a Marxist communist since he was a teenager. Maybe that's why. Well, ask yourself, how many communist teenagers joined the United States Marines? And in fact, joined the United States Marines, they try to join before they're even old enough. That's how desperate he was to be in the Marines. When Oswald was in the Marines, he spouted a love of all things Russian so much his fellow Marines called him Oswaldskovich. Now, this is in the McCarthy-Nixon 50s. And guess how many times his drill sergeant, you know, Marine drill sergeants, you know, are known for being tough guys, right? Guess how many times Oswald was ever written up or disciplined for spouting his love of all things Russian, reading Russian books, supposedly teaching himself the notoriously difficult Russian language. How many times?
I'm going to guess zero.
That's exactly
right. Let's do this. I'm looking at the clock. 5 minutes left. The book, The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination. Lamar Waldron is the author and my guest. It's the definitive account of the most controversial crime of the 20th century. Lamar Waldron pins it directly on mafia godfather Carlos Marcello. It is published by Counterpoint. And you can go, the book's title is also the website, thehiddenhistoryofthejfkassassination.com. We've now got about 4.5 minutes. Let's breeze through some of this stuff and not the details of it. The details are in this book and also in the Legacy of Secrecy, co-authored by Tom Hartman, one of the premier talk show hosts in America. This is being made into a film by Leonardo DiCaprio, and it's starring De Niro?
Yeah, Leonardo DiCaprio will be Jack Van Lanningham, you know, the FBI informant in prison, and his cellmate, Carlos Marcello, will be Robert De Niro. You know, who doesn't want to see Carlos Marcello play, De Niro play another godfather?
So they're going to put this, they're essentially, Leonardo DiCaprio is essentially going to present the theory or the proofs that you've come up with. Now, I would say that if you ask the people that think it was a conspiracy, overwhelmingly people would say it was the CIA.
Well, let me make something really clear, because there's a lot of misinformation that floats around on the internet, and I won't name names about who's spreading it, but, you know, that says we only blame the assassination on the mafia, which has never been true. From the very first book we wrote, and also in Legacy of Secrecy, and then this book, we've always pointed out the way the mafia was able to get away with it was they were working with people in the CIA. In fact, Two of the CIA people actually confessed, and one came pretty darn close to it. So the head of operations for the Miami CIA station, a guy named David Morales, biggest CIA station in the world, wasn't in Moscow or Europe. It was in Miami in 1963. The head of operations for that outfit, the CIA there, he confessed his role in the murder. A CIA asset by the name of John Martino, who worked for Santo Trafficante, he later confessed his role. By the way, David Morales, the head of operations for the CIA at Miami Station, he was working closely with Johnny Roselli on the CIA's plots to assassinate Fidel, plots that had been withheld from John and Robert Kennedy.
Well, we are barely scratching the surface here, and that's why Lamar Waldron has written several books on this. He's been doing research.
But this
for...
is by far the shortest book. This is only 900 pages.
Movies being made, but here, in just about a minute left, I actually bring this up every November 22nd, and I think you were on maybe last year or the year before on this broadcast, and someone said, and it was a person like in their 20s on the talk show that I do, and they said, who cares? I mean,
Here's why people should care. People may have heard that John Kerry basically said recently he believed in a conspiracy, but he pointed the finger at Cuba. The reason the United States... And he's not the first Secretary of State to do that. Officials from Lyndon Johnson through Al Haig when he was Reagan's Secretary of State through John Kerry, they're high officials in our government in the past and now who think Fidel Castro was behind JFK's murder. That's why we don't have normal relations with Cuba when we've made peace with Vietnam, with what we used to call Red China, but not with Cuba because they're people that think, you know, Castro killed JFK. In the book, I show all the evidence implicating Castro was planted by the mafia and their allies in the CIA. But the problem is because hundreds of thousands of JFK assassination files are still secret, even though there's a law from 92 that says they should be released. These officials don't realize that. People like John Kerry, who I believe is a good man ordinarily, you know, and does great stuff, but he doesn't realize that. So as long as the JFK assassination files, hundreds of thousands of pages, are still secret 50 years after his murder, we can't ever have our normal relations with Cuba. Think of all the wonderful people up in Michigan. Wouldn't they love to be on Havana Beach?
Absolutely.
In February or March, you know?
I've done it.
But
well,
they can't go.
We are absolutely out of time. And as you can tell, Lamar Waldron is filled with information. And, I mean, I wish we had about 5.5 hours.
If people will go to my website, and there's a link so you can sign the White House petition to get all these files released.
That's great. And the book, Lamar Waldron's latest book, The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination, the definitive account of the most controversial crime of the 20th century. This is not conspiracy theory. This is evidence as to who committed the crime, and in this case, led by Mafia godfather Carlos Marcello. As always, Lamar Waldron, and all this will be linked on my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Lamar Waldron, as always, thanks for being on the broadcast.
Hey, Peter, you're always great. I'm always glad to come on.
Thanks for listening to Night Call on 101 The Riff. Peter will be back with another guest in just a moment. Night Call. Night Call.
Let me tell you about Charity Motors. If you're looking for a 2013 tax deduction, it's got to be Charity Motors, and here's why. This late in the year, if you donate your car to somebody else, you'll only be able to write off their sale price at the time of the sale. And at this point, it's most likely not going to sell by the end of the year, which means you're going to have to wait to write it off on your 2014 taxes. On top of that, the amount you write off is going to be a lot less than the fair market value. Not with Charity Motors. They're different. They're the only car donation program in Michigan who can guarantee the full fair market value tax deduction at the time of donation. Not when the car sells. Because Charity Motors is the only car donation program that sells your car only to low-income people who really need it. And, of course, it's only Charity Motors that allows you to pick the charity of your choice to receive the proceeds from your car donation. Get your fair market value tax deduction for 2013 guaranteed. Call them today at 888-908-CARS. They'll even pick up the car for you. Call Charity Motors right now at 888-908-CARS. Call Charity Motors for a guaranteed 2013 full fair market value tax deduction. CharityMotors.org.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. You've got it on the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here's Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werbe here with you. This country has had an awful history of race relations, going back from its origins. And so much of the origins of the country have to do with slavery. And so much even in this modern era, race relations and the questions revolving around there have not been settled. And a while ago, although you don't hear too much of this anymore, particularly but during the 1950s and the 1960s, people that wanted integration were called race mixers, and women who went out with African-American men were called the N-word lovers, and that was maybe in some ways like the absolute worst epithet that could be leveled into these racist folks. But this history of integration, of people seeing that there's something worthwhile in even the culture of people that were the most disliked in American society, you know, black people, African American people, that whites saw there was a lot there, a lot of culture there worth looking at. And we're going to go back to the 1920s, and this is a period where there was a number of white upper-class women who went to Harlem. There was something going on called the Harlem Renaissance, the Black Renaissance. The book is called Miss Anne in Harlem, The White Women of the Black Renaissance. And the author is Carla Kaplan. She's an award-winning professor and writer who holds the Stanton W. and Elizabeth K. Davis Distinguished Professorship in American Literature at Northeastern University. And she's taught at a number of other universities, including Yale, has a credible history of books behind her as well. And we welcome her to our broadcast. We're reaching at her office in Boston. Carla Kaplan, welcome to the Peter Werbe Show.
Thanks so much for having me today.
I thought I was going to interview myself there for a while, but I want to get you in on this. So we go back to the 1920s, a heavily stratified racial society, no integration, segregation reigns, and yet white upper-class women are going to Harlem. What was their fascination? What drew them to this all-black area of New York City, and also in that maybe your fascination with them?
Well, you know, there were really two different kind of groups or waves of white women that were going to Harlem for very distinct reasons. And there's one group of women, a large group of white women, who were going to Harlem that we've known about for a long time. And these were the women who were part of what was a very substantial tourist phenomenon of whites who flocked to Harlem, particularly on Friday and Saturday nights, with the idea that being exposed in a very brief way, a few hours, you know, of an evening, that being exposed to black culture, particularly through dance and music, would be both exotic for them and revitalizing. And this is a period in American culture where primitivism is very widespread, and it's this notion that white culture is somehow depleted or washed out, and that it needs to be revitalized and re-energized by so-called primitive others. So some primitivists look to Tahiti, and I think a lot of people have seen some of those paintings. Some primitivists look to the Southwest, and they felt that Native Americans could infuse white culture with a needed energy. And many looked to Africa, or more closely to Africa, to African American culture, particularly in Harlem. Langston Hughes described the vogue for the Harlem Renaissance. He described the white vogue for Harlem. It was really quite a phenomenon. There was a tourist industry specifically designed for white people with what were called pleasure maps of the Harlem nightclubs. There were tourist guides specifically written for whites, whether they came from New York or they came from Kansas for their once-in-a-lifetime trip to New York. And they were told that, you know, seeing Harlem is part of the must-see of a New York trip, along with the Statue of Liberty. Some of the famous nightclubs, the ones that people remember to this day, like the Cotton Club, had a whites-only policy for their patrons. They were completely geared to this vogue, this fascination with black Harlem that was part of a primitivist culture, a primitivist movement that saw blackness as so different from whiteness that it was exotic.
I was just going to use that phrase, exoticism. So
exactly.
It had, even though that was appreciated, it still had a racialist or even racist a notion to it.
Oh, absolutely racist, because it's a hierarchy, right, of sort of the normal to the exotic, the normal to the abnormal. But it was a fascination, and it was happening concurrently with, as you've already referenced, a period in our history which is one of the most violent in American racial history, a period where racism is particularly virulent. This is the period, you know, we think about the jazz age in terms of big parties and wild music and taboos that are kind of falling, you know, and hemlines that are rising. But this is a period in which the race line is being drawn with vehemence across the nation. This is the period of the rise of the Ku Klux Klan and like-minded organizations. There were many in addition to the Klan.
In the North as well.
In the North as well as in the South. And it is the period in which lynching, the numbers of lynching, is rising almost steadily across each year in the 1920s. This is the period in which there's a really violent backlash to the valor with which black troops had fought in World War I and been decorated in Europe. They come home to find that really Jim Crow is, if not the law of the land, the rule, even in the North in many places. So this is a period in which the race line is being maintained very violently. And yet there's this shallow or surface fascination with black culture. There's been quite a bit that's been written on the phenomenon of the Harlem Vogue and the white tourist culture, particularly the nightclub culture. But this is a book that's not really about that phenomenon. That's about a much smaller group of white women, really about five dozen.
And the book is called Miss Anne in Harlem, The White Women of the Black Renaissance. And my guest is Carla Kaplan, the author. And let's explain a little about Miss Anne. I was surprised to see it here because I always thought of that was a Southern plantation phrase. There was Mr. Charlie and Miss Anne, but that was used in
yes.
the North as well, huh?
Well, in fact, Mr. Charlie or Mr. Eddie. And Miss Anne, and I do think it's a Southern phrase. I think it's a phrase, as far as we can tell, and we'll never be 100% sure, that was generated by black female domestics as a way behind their backs, always behind their backs, to refer to their white female employers, women they could not afford to disrespect or disregard to their faces, and in whose kitchens they were often trapped for 17, 18 hours a day. Behind their backs, they could deride these white women as Miss Anne, and they could put them in a category and dismiss them, which was a nice little way for black women to turn the tables just a bit on what had been done to them. The phrase has quite a bit of currency throughout the Harlem Renaissance. You see it appear over and over again in the literature of the Harlem Renaissance in very small asides. It continues to be used for some time after, and you can still find it today. Little Richard has a wonderful song, Miss Anne. Maya Angelou puts Miss Anne in a poem. So it every now and then will still crop up, but I do not think it was a phrase that was recognized, at least until my book came out, in white communities. Mm-hmm. I think it was a phrase that's always been recognized in black communities. It is a derisive term, and I use it in the title not only to signify and to symbolize that we still live in divided worlds where a phrase can be instantly recognized by black readers and a little befuddling, frankly, for white readers, but also because the women I write about who were not casual nightclub goers, but were white women looking for a range of different reasons and with a range of different outcomes to see if they could make a serious contribution to the black cultural and political renaissance. They were up against, on the one hand, a white racist culture, which said to them, you may not do this. And if you do this, you can't come home again. We're done with you. That's it. But they were also up against the very well-earned skepticism of the black community.
I was going to say, yeah, right? that was further into, because I was what they must have received, and these were upper class women. I mean, there has always been some among the so-called lower classes. There's been a lot more integration, but there was the idea that that the ruling orders ought to have a certain strict definition, and that did not include going to Harlem, marrying black men, just even doing cultural events with them. So how were they received? And well, let's put some names and some identities on who the women that you study in Miss Anne in Harlem were. Who were these women, and why in the world were they? Did they commit such transgressive acts for that repressive era?
And for me, much of the fascination of telling their stories is to get behind exactly those two things. How were they seen by the black community from whom they sought acceptance? When they first arrived, they were very much seen as Miss Anne. Oh, my God, we don't need you. What are you doing here? And how did they get past that to some kind of acceptance? But what was it they were trying to do? So I picked six women who exemplify both a range of ways white women came to Harlem. Some came as hostesses, some as patrons, some as editors, some as activists, some as philanthropists, some as writers, and some as wives, lovers, and mothers. And I also picked six women who exemplify a range of motives, from motives that we can really say were quite advanced as anti-racist political agendas, really quite progressive, to motives we would have to say are just cringeworthy, women who were really looking for a narrower set of reasons to appropriate black culture. So I did pick six women who are very different and who sort of cover both of those ranges. The first is someone who never made it to Harlem. She was always imagining Harlem. She was a woman writer named Lillian E. Wood, who taught for decades in one of the small black colleges that grew up in the wake of the freedmen's schools that were founded after emancipation in the South. She had gone from the north to the south, as many Yankee school marms had done before her, to teach in an all-black school. And for decades, she passively passed as a black woman. She wrote an anti-lynching novel that was such a strong statement about black culture and such a strong indictment of white women for failing to oppose lynching that everyone always assumed she was a black writer.
Hmm.
And she never corrected the record. She was a librarian. She certainly knew. Like any librarian, she looked herself up, of course, in the bibliographies and the anthologies. And she saw that she was always listed as a black writer, and she never corrected the record. And I start with her because I think the issue of passing is so interesting. And the next woman I talk
passing
about...
Passing in that matter. Usually passing is thought of as blacks passing for white. But
exactly.
Here, yeah. But and there's a long history of particular musicians who say that you'll see them described as saying they were white but lived black. And
certainly. And Mez Mezro being perhaps the sort of most well-known among them, right?
Yeah.
There has always been a long-standing, but I would say a much smaller phenomenon of whites passing for black than blacks. I'm sorry, of blacks passing for white than whites passing for black. Blacks had to do this for economic reasons, for reasons of social advancement, to get into careers and professions from which they were foreclosed. The whites who did it, by and large, were entertainers. Many more men than women, as far as we can tell, although there were some dancers who found it useful to do this in the 1920s. It's a much smaller group of white women who pass for black, whether in part or in any kind of permanent way. And they're going against the economic grain for the most part when they do that. So it makes for a really different story. The second woman in my book is a woman named Josephine Cogdell Schuyler, a white woman born to a very racist community in Texas. Father was a charter member of the Klan, who marries one of Harlem's most important black writers, George Schuyler. And in her life, as the mother of a biracial child and the wife of a black man, she decides to pass as a number of personae that she creates in her writing, including as a black woman. It's one of my favorite stories in the book, named Julia Jerome. And Julia Jerome is the black Ann Landers of the nation. She's in the most important black newspaper. Black women are writing to her from across the country for advice, right, about their husbands and their boyfriends and their children and their brothers. And she's dispensing girl talk to black women across. Well, she's a white writer passing for black. So I really happen to just find that just amazing that she did that and pulled it off throughout the 20s and early 30s.
The book, people join us, as you know they do, in driving the cars.
Yep.
I want to keep introducing you as my guest, Carla Kaplan. Her website is just Carla Kaplan, that's Kaplan with a K, .com, CarlaKaplan.com. There'll be a link on my website as well, PeterWerby.com. The book is Miss Anne in Harlem, The White Women of the Black Renaissance. It's published by Harper, and it's got an amazing reception, but people very interested in it. You know, you said, and I don't know if we, I want to make sure we get as much in about the general concept of the book as possible, and we're doing this partly through all of the women that you wrote about, I'm afraid we'll run out of time if we go through each one of them. The thing I think is a bit unexplained is why would a librarian in Tennessee want to write a book like this? Why would a well-off woman want to commit these transgressive racial acts by going up to Harlem? Were you able to discover their motivations?
And, you know, why would Nancy Cunard give up the Cunard fortune, right?
That's right.
To involve herself in black civil rights, a question she was asked all her lifetime, by the way. Why did you do this thing? So there's one thing that binds all six of the women together, from Lillian Wood to Nancy Cunard. Every one of these women looked at the options that were available to them as women in their moment, and they said, oh, this is not good enough. This is not a wide enough sphere. I can't have a big enough impact. And each of them sought to step outside what was available to her and find some sphere where she could both have a bigger impact and in some way be more noticeable, make a bigger mark. Now, I say that cautiously because some of the women wanted to make a very big mark, like Mary White Ovington, a founder of the NAACP, a white woman from Brooklyn Heights. She didn't want to be personally famous. She didn't think that was appropriate for white women and black civil rights, but she did want to make a much bigger mark than she could have made if she'd followed the script she was handed. The script she was handed said, marry a rich man, have dinner parties, and play whist. Mm-hmm. And she looked at that and said, oh, no, I need to change the world. So each of these women wanted to change the world. Some came to Harlem looking to contribute to black civil rights and black advancement in very sophisticated ways. Some were primitivists, like Charlotte Mason, who believed she could heal white culture by channeling Africa through Harlem, and she called herself the Earth's psychic physician. But all of them wanted to make a mark and have a bigger sphere for their activity, and that is part of what brought each of them into Harlem, and then they each did a variety of things with that desire.
How were they received within the not so much in Harlem, but within the Black Renaissance? Because there certainly was a strong thread of Black nationalism, and oftentimes there's a resentment of by Black women of Black men who want to have relationships with white women. So there's all that psychosexual social stuff going on. So that's about five questions. But given that the trends of Black nationalism in the 1920s in Harlem, here come these white women. How were they perceived?
Well, you know, not just Black nationalism, but the history of what white women had meant in Black culture and to Black culture. Really, white women had come to be symbols of danger because they were so often used as the excuse for racial violence. And then symbols of white failure, because so many white women used in that way as excuses for racial violence failed to take a stand against it. And the black community had waited decade after decade for white women to stand up and say, stop using us to lynch black men. And, you know, decade after decade, that did not, by and large, happen. So there was not a lot of immediate welcome for this group of white women who came to Harlem and said, sign me up, I want to be a member, make me part of the Renaissance. Indeed, there was an enormous amount of skepticism, and it's reflected throughout the literature of the Harlem Renaissance. There's a minor Miss Anne character in almost every novel of the Harlem Renaissance. And it was a way of talking about, carefully, not, you know, talking about this phenomenon. What was interesting is that almost all the women I write about, what they became determined to do was win the approval of the community in the face of that skepticism. So Annie Nathan Meyer, who is known today as the white Jewish founder of Barnard College, but was famous further in the Renaissance for a play called Black Souls, one of the most scandalous plays of the 1920s and 30s. One of the things she was proudest of in her entire life was that she won the title, as a white Jewish woman, of Negro dramatist. Huh. She was always referred to as a Negro playwright, and she was as proud of that as she was of founding Barnard College. For her, you know, getting over that skepticism. Same with Nancy Cunard. Nancy Cunard lost almost everything she had ever owned, and she lost the massive British Cunard fortune. But one of the few things she managed to keep with her until her really tragic death, she came to a terrible, terrible end, but she kept a scrapbook of responses from the black community to her anthology Negro, which was the largest anthology of interracial writings ever published. I think it remains so to this day, by the way. The thing weighs 10 pounds. It's 850 pages. What? And even though she lost everything else that had ever been dear to her, she managed to hold on to the scrapbook of letters praising her for getting it right, for getting race, for being a white woman who really understood it. And that praise, as a white woman who came in to such skepticism and such death threats, when she came from Britain to Harlem, she actually had to hide in upstate New York for a month. The death threats were so severe. People were trying to kill her. The Klan was trying to kill her, and racists were trying to kill her. My dog is weighing in here. And she was so proud of managing to win the approval of the black community. She carried, as I say, these scrapbooks with her till she died. Mm-hmm. Lillian E. Wood, I think she was so proud of being the only white teacher in this all-black school that she never corrected the record. She loved writing in a way that blacks thought was written by a black woman. So for many of these women, acceptance in the community was the thing they sought most, and it was very hard won if it came at all.
You've done so much work on well, on this book and other things having to do with black culture and the black community. If Carla Kaplan was back there in the 1920s, would you have been Miss Anne in Harlem as well?
Oh, what an interesting question, and nobody's ever asked it. I would certainly have been a white woman in Harlem in some sense. I would certainly have wanted at the very least to witness, if I could, to participate in what was then the single most exciting cultural movement happening in the nation. Nowhere else was as interesting to be. Would I have been derided and dismissed as Miss Anne? It's very possible. I think that the community was very skeptical about these women, and it's part of what made them so interesting, how hard they worked to see if they could move beyond the backgrounds they were raised in, if they could leave behind the kind of prejudicial assumptions that they took for granted, that their culture took for granted, and to see if they could grow beyond that. And that's what made them all so interesting to watch.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the broadcast. Carla Kaplan has been my guest, and she is an award-winning professor of and holds the Stanton W. and Elizabeth K. Davis Distinguished Professorship in American Literature at Northeastern University. The book is Miss Anne in Harlem, The White Women of the Black Resistance. You can go to her website. It's her name, Carla Kaplan, Kaplan with a K, carlakaplan.com, and I'll certainly have a link on my website. Fascinating book. I want to thank you for taking the time to tell us about it.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or sponsors of WRIF Radio or of its parent company, Greater Media Incorporated. Stay tuned. There's more rock coming right up on 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks. Night Call. Night Call.
I try to find the right one, but it seems like they all just have one thing on their mind.
Having only one thing on your mind can be a good thing when you find that special someone. At Geico.com, that someone is a car insurance policy, and the only thing on its mind is being your soulmate. Depend on easy online tools for paying bills and managing claims. Picture a life of savings as you gaze into the eyes of a free rate quote. That's our go-to move. Geico, 15 minutes could save you hundreds on car insurance.
Hey, music lovers. Tired of your music buffering while you're running around? Here's a reality check. Verizon's 4G LTE is the most reliable and in more places than any other 4G network. Reliability you can believe in. That's powerful. Verizon. Click on the banner to compare the maps.
Business owners, do you want to double your sales in 12 months? Chet Holmes International's track record for the past 3 decades speaks for itself. Our legendary founder and best-selling author of The Ultimate Sales Machine, Chet Holmes, explains.
Why does one person open a business and you go back 30 years later and basically they've made themselves a job, not a business? Another person opens up a business and in 10 years they have 60 locations and cash out a multimillionaire. The difference between the two is not the product or the service, folks. It's the skills and learning curve of the entrepreneur.
We've created a serious training program. 4 ways to double sales in 12 months. And we'll give this to any serious business owner who calls 800-936-0222. Leave us a voicemail with your email to get this powerful audio training program at our expense. Call right now. It's a heck of a gift. See if you agree. 800-936-0222. That's 800-936-0222. From Chet Holmes International to your success.
More Riff Rock now. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Bring that moment of freak out.
Everything that rocks.
You wanna punch me like I don't mind. You wanna break.